The fifth World Water Forum, being held in Turkey, has the slogan, Bridging Divides for Water. Yet the conference is organized by a corporate-led group whose members stand accused of creating, and then profiting from, limiting access to water. Those corporations include Coca-Cola, Nestle, PepsiCo, and the French multinational Suez. Support for a human right to water is being kept out of the forum's final statement. Meanwhile, activists peacefully protesting outside the World Water Forum have been tear-gassed, jailed, and deported.
Police say 21-year-old Eric Montanez with the group Food Not Bombs broke the law by feeding more than 25 people as Orlando's ordinance allows.
Not against the law to feed people. And as much as they want to criminalize the help of the homelessness.
Undercover officers worked surveillance and counted how many people Montanez fed, 30. So Orlando police say they are simply enforcing the laws.
Montanez faces a misdemeanor charge for feeding a large group in a city-owned park. And according to police, no organization had obtained the required permit.
Let us look back at last week in radical efforts, and the following is this week in radical history for the week starting March 23rd.
There is something going on in the east side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in radical history for March 23rd, 1842, Congressman Giddings of Ohio is censured by the House of Representatives for introducing resolution opposing slavery and coastal slave trade. The gag rule, first adopted by self-dominated Congress in 1836, pledges every member not to mention slavery issue on the floor of the House. But freedom.
On this day, March 23rd, in 1889, U.S. President Benjamin Harrison declared that in 1 month's time, on April 22nd, vast amounts of land in the Oklahoma Territory would be open for settlers to claim homesteads upon. Oklahoma was initially set aside as a destination for Native Americans who were forcibly evicted or coerced from their ancestral lands east of the Mississippi. The opening of Oklahoma created what was called a land rush as prospective homesteaders stampeded across the state line at the prescribed hour.
Also March 23rd, 1967, in Bolivia, Che Guevara's guerrilla group experienced its first battle of the Bolivian campaign. The U.S.-backed Bolivian president appeals to the nation to, quote, join the fight against the foreign and local anarchists with arms and money from Castro's communists, unquote. Also in 1970, President Nixon declares a national emergency, orders 30,000 troops to New York City to break the postal wildcat strike.
In 1982, a coup occurred in Guatemala, replacing the democratically elected president with a military commander, Efren Rios Montt. Montt was a graduate of the U.S. Military Terrorist Training School facility called the School of the Americas in Columbus, Georgia. And like scores of other graduates of that fine institution, Montt waged a campaign of assassinations and torture against his opposition and labor leaders in Guatemala. He especially targeted Guatemala's Mayan population, and according to a UN report, Montt was responsible for the killing of more than 10,000 Guatemalans and the destruction of some 600 villages. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, March 23rd. This Day in History is a production of the Daybird Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Proving once again that America was not founded on religious freedom but intolerance, as of on this day on March 24th, 1661, Willie Ledra is executed, his crime being a Quaker. Also on March 24th, 1977, an Argentinian author, Rodolfo Walsh, writes an open letter to the U.S.-backed military junta in regards to its crimes. A day later, the dictatorship assassinates him. His body and some writings will never be seen again. Also on this date in 1978, the Wampanoag claims to land in Cape Cod is dismissed by U.S. District Court in Boston because they had no tribal status in 1869. Tribal status is finally granted to them 9 years later without most of their Cape Cod lands. Also on March 24, 1988 in Israel, after a secret 7-month trial, an employee in a bomb-making factory is convicted of espionage for revealing details of the Israeli atomic weapons program to the London Sunday Times. His revelations show Israel's nuclear capability to the greater extent than experts assumed, and that Israel could build up to 200 atomic bombs as well as neutron and hydrogen bombs. He got 18 years in prison, and 10 years later, in 1998, he's allowed out of solitary confinement for the first time. To this date, Israel still not signed the U.S.-touted nuclear arms agreement forced on other nations, let alone own admitting they have nukes at all. More U.S. double standards. Lastly, on this date in 2003, Michael Moore in Hollywood Doghouse, following last night's Academy Awards for denouncing President Bush and his war on the Iraqi people. Moore was roundly booed and jeered by the bulk of Hollywood's finest patriots. Liberal Hollywood? Yeah, right. This week in radical history for March 25th, 1812 in Russia, anarchist sympathizer Alexander Herson lives in Moscow. Journalist, political writer, novelist, influenced by revolution and the French socialism, took an active part in the revolution of 1848 in Paris and Rome, and founded the influential newspaper The Bell in London. Also March 25th, 1873, Rudolf Rocker lives. American immigrant Rudolf Rocker was an anarcho-syndicalist, theorist, organizer, and anti-fascist. He became deeply involved in the Jewish anarchist movement, author of important works including Nationalism and Culture. Part of the book he describes the emergence and development of religion. Rocker claims religion has enslaved its very creator, man, since man must submit itself to the mysterious powers over which he cannot control. He also implies that this criticism to modern-day politics. According to Nationalism and Culture, man is submitted to an all-powerful state just as he is to an all-powerful God. Thus, Rocker claims, quote, "We arrive at the very foundation of every system of rulership and recognize that all politics in its last instant religion, and that such ties hold the spirit of man in chains of dependence." Rudolf Rocker. Also on this date in 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. The Triangle Shirtwaist Company, occupying the top 10 floors of a building in New York City, is consumed by fire. 147 people, mostly women and young girls, ages between 13 and 23, in working sweatshop conditions, lose their lives. Approximately 50 died as they leaped from windows of the street, and others burned or trampled to death, desperately trying to escape via stairwell's exit, illegally locked to prevent the interruption of work. Company owners are charged with 7 counts of manslaughter, but are found not guilty. A lot more happened in this day. In 1916, Ishii dies. He's the last known Native American tribesperson to come out of the wilderness. After his last holdouts of his tribe, his mother and sister ran away from white settler surveyors. He would never see them again. And after a couple of years of loneliness in the California wilderness, he decides to come into a town. For a good book on the life of Ishii, read Ishii in Two Worlds.
Moloch, who entered my soul early! Moloch, in whom I am a consciousness without a body! Moloch, whom I abandon, wake up in Moloch, light streaming out of the sky.
On this date in 1955, Moloch. U.S. Customs confiscate Moloch. 520 copies of Allen Ginsberg's Howl as they enter the U.S. It'll then be published by City Lights Publishers in San Francisco. 1 year later on this date, the government seizes more copies printed at City Lights and charge a publisher with violating obscenity laws. Let freedom ring.
I'm with you in Rockland, where you will split the heavens of Long Island and resurrect your living human Jesus from the superhuman tomb.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. This morning we will hear Israeli new historian Ilan Pappe's recent presentation delivered at Harvard University. Pappe teaches at Exeter University in the United Kingdom, is the author of several books, including the definitive The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, and is a frequent lecturer throughout the world. He is a frequent visitor to the Boston area, and whenever he is here, This Week in Palestine tries to cover him. Here is Ilan Pappe speaking at Harvard University.
It's a great pleasure to be here. I want to thank Tree of Life
for organizing this lecture tour, which starts here, and thank you all for making the effort tonight and joining me in discussing a very important issue, the Palestine issue. In 2014, in the summer of 2014, it was not difficult to convince the world that Palestine is still an issue that deserves international attention and concern. The brutal Israeli attack on Gaza through that summer secured the attention of the world through the main TV channels, mainstream media, and even politicians for at least the duration of the suffering of the Palestinians in Gaza. And this was in spite of the fact that already we were a third year into the horrific civil war in Syria. We already were aware of the atrocities committed in Iraq, in Yemen, in Libya. And yet Palestine succeeded, if this is a success, to attract the attention of the world for these horrible days, those horrible days in the summer. What the brief moment of refocusing on Palestine told us in the summer of 2014 was that for a moment, and we have to expand that moment, there's no doubt, but for a moment, even the more cynical journalists and pundits and academics and experts who were interested in the Middle East could not escape the connection between what they have seen in Gaza and what they knew happened in Gaza before 2014 and what they witnessed elsewhere in the Middle East. This connection is not always made. Usually, in fact, the context works against the Palestinians. Namely, if you try to convince mainstream journalists, academics, even politicians, to pay attention to what's going on in Palestine, they would tell you, yes, but you know there are much worse things happening in Syria and Iraq. There's a refugee crisis in Europe. Palestine needs to take a back stage door or a backstage place because it is not as horrific as the events in Syria and Iraq. It's not as urgent as the refugee crisis in Europe. But in the summer of 2014, if you read the commentary, if you listen to the news bulletins, you can see that people began to make a connection, which unfortunately they didn't do before and haven't done afterwards. But it's important to hang on to that connection because I think it tells us something about the topic tonight, about Palestine as an issue. Because people had to ask themselves, what is the Gaza Strip? What is going on in the Gaza Strip? And it was very clear that what you had was a huge city called the Gaza City with some smaller towns around it that became a battlefield. A field that on which Israel experimented some of the world's deadliest and most lethal weapons, and which it used them in such an intensity that hasn't been seen before in the Middle East. In fact, before the attack on Gaza in 2014 and before the attacks on Gaza in 2006, 2012, 2014, and before the horrible developments in Syria and Iraq, the Middle East did not experience such herbicide, such genocide of a town or of a city before. Yes, there were some quite horrendous chapters in the history of cities or towns in the Middle East before 2002, when Israel attacked in a similar fashion West Bank cities and towns, there was the attack of Hafez al-Assad on Hama in 1982. There was an attack of the Egyptian army of the Giza Quarter in 1981. In 1962, the Egyptian army was quite brutal in its attack on Yemen during its war with Saudi Arabia. But these were very infrequent incidents of brutality that the Middle East has escaped even during the First and the Second World War compared to other parts of the world. And few of the people who were analyzing the reality in Gaza in 2014 made the effort, but we should thank them for doing that, of asking themselves what's the connection between the callousness and brutality of the Israeli attack on Gaza and the history of the Middle East or the history of Palestine. And the first thing that came to their mind, and definitely comes to my mind, is that in fact it is not in 2002, it's not during the 21st century that we witness for the first time the employment of massive military power within the civilian space in order to gain political interests. This was done in 1948. In 1948, it was the first time in the history of the modern Middle East that cities were ethnically cleansed, were destroyed, were wiped out of the map of a country. What was remarkable, of course, of the 48 herbicide, the destruction of the urban space, that of course was accompanied by the destruction of the countryside of Palestine in 1948, what was remarkable, of course, that the 1948 crimes were off the radar of the international community. Not that people didn't know. People did not make the effort to care. And the victims of that herbicide and that destruction of the Palestinian countryside south of Jaffa, the victims of these people, of these atrocities, were pushed into the Gaza Strip. Now, nobody called Gaza the Gaza Strip. This was an invention of Israel, because Israel was looking for a huge space into which it could squeeze the ethnically cleansed Palestinians south of Palestine, in the south of Palestine. So they pushed them into what used to be a very pastoral, beautiful part of Palestine. The town of Gaza, it was not a city, the town of Gaza, with small villages across the coast, mainly fishing villages, and they pushed these hundreds of thousands of refugees into the Gaza Strip, called it a strip, closed it down, and created the biggest refugee camp upon earth. And in 2006, for the first time, they bombed the refugee camp that they created, because that refugee camp dared to resist the continued confinement and ghettoizing, the ghettoized reality that Israel created for it ever since 1967. But it was already within this abnormal state of a refugee camp or a prison camp since 1948. Now, in that rare moment in the summer of 2014, where the world was willing for a short moment to put the issue of Palestine at the head of the news, at the top of the international agenda, at that particular moment, it was easy, or relatively easy, to remind people of the two contexts which make Palestine a relevant issue even today. One was the historical context, which I've just explored, but I will explore a bit more later. And the other one was the contemporary context. What was the connection? What is the connection between what goes on in Syria and Iraq and the rest of the Middle East and the future of Palestine? So we should capitalize on that moment in history when what for those of us who have been activists, committed activists for so many years, was so clear, became for a brief moment clear also to the wider community. But of course the price was horrible. Namely, you needed the killing fields of Gaza of 2014 to remind the world that Palestine is still there. And that despite of everything that goes on in Iraq and Syria, Palestine is still there. And maybe there is a connection, a historical connection, a contemporary connection between what you see on your television screen happening in Gaza and what you would see later on happening in Damascus, Aleppo, Hamad, Raqqa, various other parts of Iraq and the various other parts of the Middle East. And this is a huge task. I mean, even when you had, quote-unquote, the fortunate historical moment where you could make this connection because Israel was so brutal in its attack on Gaza, so you could for a moment ask people to pay attention to you, to ask the questions you want them to ask. Even at that moment, it was not that easy to find the space and the structure to explain why Palestine is still relevant when everything else is happening around us, especially, as I mentioned before, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. So let me explore these two contexts, the historical context and the contemporary context, because I think they're not just important for explaining why Palestine is still the issue. They're also important for understanding the way forward in the case of Palestine. I think the two are interconnected, our analysis and prognosis. So historically, Palestine is connected to the events in the Middle East today because it is the last living, active settler colonialist project in the world. And when I say it is an active settler colonialist project, I mean that there are other settler colonialist societies. We are in one of them. But they are not active in that respect, that the struggle, although it may continue, the struggle of the indigenous people, the settler colonialist project itself succeeded. Was completed and belongs to an historical period which you can either analyze and say or put aside in a way by saying that most of it is behind you, that you can deal with the fruits of that history, but you're not part of that history. This is not true about Palestine. It was also not true about South Africa a few years ago. And maybe it's still not over in South Africa, for all we know. So, Palestine is the last living case study of European settlers pushing themselves forcefully into the homeland of a native people. Yes, it has its exceptional features, of course. It has the moral power of the guilt complex of Europe and America because of the Holocaust. It has the power of American Jews behind it as a strong ally in international relations. It has the power of neoliberalism as an ally in the high-tech economy, arms trade, and other features of the new economic order we live in. But doesn't matter. Without, even with all these exceptional features, What really matters is that it is a settler colonialist project in the making. They are still settling. They are still colonizing. And there is a logic to a settler colonialist project. And that logic was so beautifully articulated in the book by one of our best authors on settler colonialism, who unfortunately passed away 2 weeks ago, Patrick Wolfe, who said, the logic of a settler colonialist project is the logic of elimination. You cannot hope for a settler colonial project to succeed if you don't eliminate the native. This country is the proof to what it means. Australia, New Zealand, South America, to mention but few of the most important historical examples we have. When the logic of elimination is applied to the 21st century, it becomes a complex picture. What does it mean if we define Israel as a settler colonialist state, the Palestinians as natives, and Israel is being propelled by the logic of elimination? Does it mean that Israel is busy genociding the Palestinians? That would be an overgeneralization that does not fit everything that's happening on the ground, although it may fit Israeli policy in the Gaza Strip. It means that elimination is not necessarily physical elimination. It means that you can eliminate a native people by fragmenting them into small groups, by cordoning them in spaces from which they cannot leave, or forbidding them from entering other spaces in their home country. You can have a complex regime that varies from apartheid to regular discrimination, from ethnic cleansing to massive killing, in order to make sure that the logic of elimination is implemented. You can even use a peace process to find a sophisticated way to implement the logic of elimination. It is impossible for the Zionist project to succeed if the logic of elimination is not going to be exercised in an effective and full way. The Israeli electorate understands it. Since 2000, it even shows this understanding through the ballot boxes. It votes for political ideologies that tell them that there's no need to play the democratic game anymore, that there is moral justification, religious justification, international justification to accelerate the process, to disregard international condemnation, and there is a need to finish it as quickly as possible. The logic of elimination, of course, is not something that only motivates settler colonialist projects. It can motivate fanatic religious groups as well, as we have seen in the Middle East. But if one ideology is regarded as the fruit of enlightenment, progress, part of Western treasure of moral philosophy, political philosophy, namely Zionism, is allowed to exercise the logic of elimination, it's quite natural that others would say in the Middle East, why should we not exercise it if we think that politically, economically, it serves our ideology? It is this 100 years of translating the logic of elimination into policy on the ground that is the legacy that Israel has given to the Middle East with regard to the Palestinians. And I'm not saying here, and I want it to be very clear, I'm not saying here that the Islamic State gets its ideas from Zionism. I'm not saying here that the cruelty shown by Muslim groups against other Muslim groups in the Middle East, or by regimes against their citizens, or by groups of citizens against other groups of citizens, are emulation of the logic of elimination. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that there is a certain moment in history where colonialism appears to be fading away from the Middle East, and colonialism in the Middle East was not as terrible as it was in Africa. We have to remember this. In other parts of the world, it was the colonialist period in the Middle East was very short, didn't have the same characteristics as colonialism in Africa or Southeast Asia. It was not as brutal. So the moment it faded away, actually, unlike in Africa, there was a moment of elation, of liberation. And apart from Algeria, this moment was not soaked in blood. And usually when your moment of birth is not a violent moment, you have a very good chance of building a non-violent post-colonialist future. But there were only two places where this was not true in the Middle East. One was Algeria, where the French insisted on holding on and killing 1 million Algerians in this attempt to hold on to Algeria. And Palestine. So what you get is an area that had the ability of actually moving into the post-colonial era in a much better condition than Africa had, in a way, but was all the time magnated into the issue of Palestine and Algeria until 1962, but then only Palestine, in a way where one group of the colonized people, or people who lived under the colonial structure, were continued to be colonized. In fact, were treated more brutally after the end of colonialism than they were treated during the time of colonialism. And that is the connection that you have between the Israeli brutal oppression of the Palestinians under the logic of elimination and the nature of Arab politics in general, including the last recent chapters in Iraq and Syria. Of course, this is counterfactual history. I cannot prove to you that had Zionism not appeared in Palestine, or had a different kind of solution been found for Palestine, I cannot prove to you that things would have been different in Syria and Iraq. Nobody can do it in history. This is counterfactual. You cannot say, had this not been happening, this would not happen. But what you can do in history is to say, you can show that violence has to emerge from somewhere. How can you explain the relative peaceful relationship between communities in the Middle East under the Ottoman Empire? How can you explain the relative calm and peaceful relationship? I say relative, these relationships can never be ideal. The calm relationship between communities in the Middle East under colonialism. And then suddenly, it disappears. Now, of course, there were other elements of violence. There were dictatorial regimes, authoritarian regimes, and so on. But are they really not related to the way the West has treated the Middle East? And is the exceptional position Israel has received from the West not connected to the Western policies towards the Middle East? The answer is, these are all connected. When Jamal Abdel Nasser in 1954 is willing to take with other Arab new leaders the Arab world into a non-aligned position. He doesn't want to be either with the Soviet Union and he doesn't want to be with the Western Bloc. He wants the Arab world to be part of a third world, which may have the chance to build something else. He is regarded by the Americans as an enemy of the United States because he is not willing to fully side with the United States. But the main reason that the United States is not patient enough to weigh all the options is, of course, that Israel pressures America to see any Arab regime that is not pro-Western as both anti-Israeli and anti-American. So these kind of relationships develop through the time where you cannot disentangle American interests in the Middle East from the American alliance with Israel. And again, I would stress it again and again, this does not mean that this is the sole reason for violence, that this is the sole reason for instability. It is not the sole reason. But it is the main feature that disables us from dealing with the more authentic problems that you have in the Middle East, whether these are issues of human rights, civil rights, factionalism, and the problems in the nation states that the two colonialist powers, Britain and France, have created after the First World War. So this is the historical context. The historical context is this whole idea that while Israel is allowed to continue policies on the ground under the logic of elimination that anywhere else in the world would be regarded as immoral, unacceptable, especially after the Holocaust, while Israel is allowed to pursue these policies, and why the tangible results of these policies are there for everyone to be seen, the rest of the Arab world is measured by an international and universal yardstick which rightly condemns any Arab regime and any Arab society for its violations of human rights and civil rights. And this is the contemporary context, not just the historical context. You cannot have conversations about human rights and civil rights in Syria, in Iraq, without unpacking two issues. You have to unpack two issues. One is you have to unpack the political structure that the colonialist powers have established after the First World War. The idea of the nation state as it was created by these two colonialist powers is disintegrating in front of our eyes. Not everywhere in the Middle East, but in many parts of the Middle East. Now, if you want to have a proper discussion about the connection between the structure of the Arab nation state, as it was created actually by foreign powers, not by authentic national movements, and the connection between that historical structure and a future solution for conflicts, including the conflict in Syria, you have to include Palestine in this. You cannot say, I will come and revisit the issue of relationship between Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds in Iraq. I will revisit the relationship between Alawites and Sunnis in Syria. I will revisit the issue of human rights in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Libya. I will ask myself again, did I ignore too much the tribal structure in North Africa, in Yemen, right? Did we all ignore certain realities on the ground when we created political structure that then we all said could only be defended through dictatorial authoritarian regimes? And if they are democratized, then they disintegrate, so we can't push for democracy in Iraq, in Syria, and Yemen, because democracy means, you know, getting rid of the power that held together what supposedly is a very fragmented society. And then we hear from all the experts that they had a long history of feuds and mutual hate and so on. You cannot even begin to talk about such reconstruction if you don't include Palestine in it. You cannot even talk about it if you don't include Lebanon in it. Now, of course, it's very clear that Lebanon, the Maronites in Lebanon, the Zionists in Israel, they don't want to reopen the question of how these political structures were born and what's wrong with these political structures and what should be the alternative political structures. Of course, they don't want to be part of that conversation, because that conversation means that the political order in the Middle East that is not working, that has caused so much suffering to people, both in the time when authoritarian regimes were ruling it, and at the time when these authoritarian regimes were challenged, the suffering of the common people continues, hasn't ended, as we know. If you want to end this suffering, if you want to reopen the question of what is the right political structure that could ensure human rights, civil rights, collective identities, prosperity, social justice, if you want to put all these five issues on the agenda, you will have to ask for these issues also to be dealt with in the context of Israel and Palestine. And the moment you decide, and this is the international community's decision, that these two are not connected, it means you continue the same exceptionalism that you showed towards Israel when it was using the logic of elimination against the Palestinian. You use the same exceptionalism when you talk about the future. Because what is the message you're giving the people? You say, I'm willing to send aircrafts from the United States, from Russia, from Saudi Arabia, from Britain, to bomb. Everybody's bombing in Syria and Iraq, as if this is a kind of what the doctor prescribed as an idea for political solution. Well, the Americans started it in 2003, so everybody emulates it, as if bombing from the air is a kind of a new substitute for dialogue between people. So everybody's bombing everyone. But of course, the Israelis were bombing everyone before that, long before the Americans bombed anyone in Afghanistan or Iraq. So, if you want to talk about something which is not bombing, which is a bit more sophisticated in terms of how you end the suffering before and after the 21st century, you need to make sure that you are sending a message to the Middle East that there are no exceptionalism. There's no exceptional case studies. Because if there are exceptional case studies, there are always groups of people, there are always ideologies, there are always politicians who would say, can we also be exceptional? Can we also violate human rights, civil rights? Can we also bomb carpet Beirut in 1982 and get no response from the international community? What does it take to be part of this club? Do we have to be Jewish? Is that the thing? Because that's the only thing they can see. They sort of ask themselves, what's the difference between the aircrafts that destroyed half of Beirut in 1982 and again in 2006? The aircraft that destroyed Ramallah? The aircraft that destroyed Gaza? And the aircraft that destroyed Raqqa or Aleppo or Baghdad or whichever other poor town is now being bombarded from the air as we speak? They ask themselves, what's the difference? What's the difference between us and them? When are we entitled to be called people who defend themselves? When will our army be called the defense army? The Syrian defense army, the Islamic State defense army, the Jubhat al-Nusra defense army. Why only the Israeli defense army? They're the only people who defend themselves in the Middle East. Everybody else is aggressive. But they are defending themselves. So this is the kind of exceptionalism that is not only historical, it's contemporary. It is contemporary. So Palestine is an issue that comes out of the treatment of Israel as an exceptional historical case study and contemporary case study. There is no doubt that the Middle East as a whole, and certain societies in it in particular, are in great need of a strong, truthful, urgent conversation about human rights, about civil rights, about group rights. There's no doubt about it. It was true also before the horrible things that happened in the last 3 or 4 years. The Middle East was always in that need after the Second World War. The question is there a connection? Am I right or am I wrong in saying that one of the main reasons, probably the most important reason, that we don't have this conversation is the exceptionalist position Israel had in the past and has in the present? That's the big question that we have to ask ourselves. And if we are convinced that the exceptionalism is what really propels, what really motivates the international community policy towards Israel and Palestine, and it is an obstacle for the rest of the Middle East, maybe then we can convince people that Palestine is an issue, not because it should be at the same place in the League of Atrocities as Syria is in this moment in time. We don't need a table of atrocities. We don't have to compare where more people are being killed and how are they being killed, in what intensity they are being killed. Actually, if you look at Palestine in the last 100 years, it's very high up, even today, in that map. It's definitely in relative terms, but even in absolute terms. Even in absolute terms. But that's not the issue. The issue is not numbers. The issue is not even the kind of weapons human beings use to get rid, to eliminate other human beings. The question is about ideologies that dehumanize someone else to such an extent that it's not a problem to get rid of them, whether massively or individually. And these dehumanizations, and this is what I want to put to you today, that this dehumanization that is at the heart of what we see in front of our eyes in Syria and Iraq, it's not religion. It's not even an ideology. It is a base dehumanization. That's what we see is happening. And this dehumanization, by the way, is not only directing a certain group or certain groups. The regimes are also directed by this dehumanization. The Western powers that supposedly are coming to help people are also directed by this dehumanization. It doesn't matter where you kill people by pushing a button on your computer or you slaughter them physically with your own hands. You can do both things if you've totally dehumanized masses of people. Now this dehumanization that Europe succeeded in getting rid of only after two world wars, for many, many years was not part of the Middle Eastern reality. But it has become part of the Middle Eastern reality. And I put it to you that the first act, the first place where this dehumanization took place was Palestine. By the way, not the first instance of such massive dehumanization was not committed by the Zionists. The first instance we have is the British military operations against the Palestinians between 1936 and 1939, when the Palestinians revolted against the pro-Zionist policy of the British Empire and started an intifada, an uprising, with hardly any weapons, mostly with the kind of sheer willpower of the people of the countryside. It was not even joined by people from the urban elite. It was mainly kind of a countryside rebellion. The British used a repertoire of dehumanized methods that would later become the manual book for Israelis when they occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. In fact, the Israelis were using them directly. And at the basis of this was total dehumanization of the native population, of the civilian population. That's the only way you can do it. The next act of dehumanization was the Nakba. You cannot treat 1,000 Palestinian villages and 12 Palestinian towns and cities as enemy bases if you don't dehumanize the people who live there. You cannot tell your soldiers these are military targets, because they will tell you, no, these are not. These are villages and towns. They're not military targets. There's no enemy bunkers there. There's no enemy tank brigades there. So you have to dehumanize them. You have to turn every child, every old man, every woman into the enemy. And I remember when I started working in 48, how shocked I was by the very direct Israeli instructions to treat every Palestinian male above the age of 10 as a soldier in the army of the enemy. So when once you dehumanize the million of Palestinians living in what became Israel, you can easily expel them massively, you can massacre them, you can prevent them from coming back home. Similarly, you cannot take a whole army of young people in Israel and turn them into wardens in two huge prison camps, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, for almost now 50 years. You cannot turn these soldiers into wardens in this military, in these prison camps that incarcerates people. And the only reason that they are incarcerated is because they are Palestinians. You cannot turn them into wardens unless you dehumanize the population. You cannot ask them to intimidate intentionally people at the checkpoints, or to break into people's homes regularly, or to frighten children by moving with your tanks at night in the refugee camps. You cannot do it if you don't dehumanize the Palestinians. You cannot send a message, they're actually also human beings, but you know, we have a fight with them, and that's the reason we're doing it. No, there's a whole DNA of dehumanization. Now, this is Israel and Palestine, but this is settler colonialism. You could not genocide the Native Americans unless you dehumanize them. And settler colonialism belongs to the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment could not have authorized, sanctioned the massacre of so many people around the world in the name of modernity if it did not dehumanize anyone who was not modern as someone who is eligible for elimination. And similar things as neoliberalism does with our workers today. They are dehumanized, they are not eliminated physically, but they are eliminated economically. You can close a factory in 2 minutes, and you don't give a damn what happens to the workers anymore. Because you don't even live in the country where the factory was closed. The logic of elimination has many faces, has many contexts in them. But Palestine is one of the clearest examples of not only how a logic of elimination works, but how it is institutionalized, how it is legitimized, and how it is protected in the name of universal values such as progress, democracy, and Western society. So when you talk, with this I will end, when you talk to people who say to you, forget about Palestine now. There are so many horrible things happening in Syria and Iraq. Why are you bothering us with Palestine? Okay, one person was killed there, another person. You know, look at the horrendous reality across the border. When you talk, I think one of the first things you should say to people is, what is the most awful outcome of the atrocities you see around you in Syria and Iraq? And the answer is refugees. Wave of refugees. People losing their homes, losing their country, having to move. Life seekers who are treated the way they are treated in Europe. Life seekers. Really, we shouldn't even call them refugees. These are people who are hanging to life. That's the only reason we find them in Europe and elsewhere. And then you say to people, okay, which are the countries who accepted these life seekers without a wink? Who opened their borders without even thinking? Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, which had its own refugee problem, opened the door for refugees who came from Syria. But there's one country, which is the richest of Syria's neighbors, that hasn't accepted even one refugee. Not even one refugee, although many of these refugees have first relatives. They have brothers and sisters and nephews and cousins 50 kilometers from the border. They didn't accept one refugee. And nobody in the world said anything about it. Nobody thought that this is a moment to ask Israel to show some humanity. Some humanization after a century of dehumanization. No. The world said the dehumanization of the Palestinians by the Israelis is understandable. It's a matter of the survival of the Jewish state. This is why Israel was never pushed to allow the Palestinian refugees to return. It didn't really matter whether the Palestinians were expelled or not. Palestinians who left should have the right to come back. But Israel said no, and the world said yes, we understand. So, Palestine is the issue because the way Israeli exceptionalism is legitimized and accepted on every aspect I've described tonight, from the history of its most violent operation, through its exemption from any conversation about human rights and civil rights in the Middle East, and to the last issue I just mentioned, not asking it whatsoever to be part of the biggest human rescue operation we have in the world, right? These three exemptions from history, from the present, and from humanitarian even request is a very clear explanation why for so many people in the world who are aware that there are other issues than Palestine, who are aware that there are worse atrocities than the ones suffered by the Palestinians, why for so many people the Palestinian flag dawns their struggle for justice. In the very same way that the struggle against American imperialism in Vietnam, against Pinochet in Chile, against apartheid in South Africa, was leading us whenever we saw injustice in the world. Not because we were not aware of other cases of injustice, but because these were the examples that brought to the fore the worst of the injustice. And in the case of Palestine, the worst thing about the injustice is the righteous fury of Israel on the one hand and the international community's silence on the other. And in between those two, you can understand why young people are risking their life in Jerusalem and why people are joining, which is very unfortunate, groups who believe in elimination in other parts of the Middle East, believing that they are contributing to the struggle against the injustice in Palestine. There is a way out of it. There's a way of stopping the injustice in Palestine. It's much easier than stopping the injustice somewhere else in the world. And I think that's also what really motivates people, by believing that it's possible, it is possible, to create a more just reality in Israel and Palestine. And it is time for us, and with this I would end, to examine my counterfactual historical analysis. Because I strongly believe that the biggest, most lethal bomb we can throw on the Middle East is a U-turn in the American policy towards Israel. This is more powerful than any atomic bomb we will ever throw on the Middle East. This kind of realization in the Middle East, the people wake up one morning and say, there's a different international atmosphere, which already is craved by you in the civil society who support the BDS, who support the Palestine cause. It's not something I'm imagining here, you know. It's possible. The civil society is already there. Why should we not believe that the governments could not one day follow us? It happened in South Africa. But this moment of awakening in the Middle East, where people would say to themselves, wait a minute, there's a genuine change in the way the international community treats us, understands us. I'm deeply, deeply convinced that the motivation to join fanatic groups, the motivation to continue violence, the motivation to eliminate and to dehumanize would diminish. I'm not saying it would disappear, but I would say it would diminish to such a size that it would make it conducive to talk for the first time genuinely after four decades in the whole of the Middle East about human rights, civil rights, and social justice as a dialogue that the people in the Middle East deserve as any other people in the world deserve. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to a lecture delivered by Israeli new historian Ilan Pape at Harvard University. We hope you will join us again next Sunday when our feature presentation will be our exclusive interview with Israeli author, activist, and co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, Jeff Halper.
When people are in their bliss and doing what they would naturally be doing if they had all their needs met, you know, and they're just having fun, they're playing, what they create actually benefits not just them, but the whole.
If what we're really on this earth to do is to spin straw into gold, it's really finally to be creative and to give that to the culture, then in order to do that, you can't be living somebody else's life.
If we choose to do what we love, our lives get better. If we choose to share it with others, the lives of those around us get better. If enough of us do this, the world gets better.
We are most free when we are most bound to others.
How oft times we go there.
You're listening to episode 735 of Unwelcome Guests, Thinking Outside the Box. I'm Robin Upton, and a more personal episode than usual, not containing a lot of reflection from me. I thought it was going to, but it didn't work out that way. You've heard a collection of quotes to give you a flavour of what's coming. A range of speakers, some new to the show, some regulars. We begin with the following recording. This is unusual in that this is somebody whom I have met personally. I was invited by a group of friends to the Chaos Computer Conference about which he speaks, and in my experience can pronounce them a profoundly sound bunch. This is Mitch Altman speaking about the rise of hacker spaces in November 2012 in Brussels.
I have a vision, a world full of centers of unique community, each supporting the individuals there to explore and do what they love. Each an inspirational source of true education, where anyone can learn what they need to live the lives they want to live. Each a vibrant hub of a local community, each supporting the other community centers to flourish. This is what the hackerspace community is all about. And it's already happening in a huge way. And how do I know? Because this is the life I live 24/7, all day, all night, all year round. In the last 63 months, over 1,100 hackerspaces have popped up all over the planet. Seemingly out of nowhere, and seemingly in very unlikely places. What is going on here? There's more popping up all the time. But what's going on is that hackerspaces provide two unique, very deep universal needs. Two needs that have been way too scarce for way too long. Community and creative expression. We all evolved as a species on the planet to survive in a sometimes hostile environment, supporting each other in community. We need community. It's in our DNA. One of the things we did in community was to get together to make and share cool tools. And just because we can now buy anything we want doesn't mean we don't need to create. We have a deep inner drive to create. It's in our DNA. Hackerspaces provide this magical combination, creative expression plus community, and brings them together, making dreams come alive. A hackerspace is a real physical space, like a storefront in LA or a warehouse in Detroit, where people are supported through supportive community to explore and do what they love through hacking. Hacking is taking what is, improving upon it to the best of your ability, and sharing it. Since anything, no matter how cool, can be improved, we can hack anything. We can hack computers and electronics, of course, but also art and craft, math, science. You can hack yourself, society, the planet. We can and do hack anything. The choices we make have a powerful impact on our lives. I started my life out as a total depressed blob of a kid. But I am now a jet-setting, crazy-haired inventor who loves my life. I started this transformation by making choices. Good choices and bad choices. I learned from my messes and successes, learning and growing, taking what is, learning to the best of my ability, and eventually sharing it. That's hacking. And it works, even if it wasn't always easy, even if it still isn't easy. But it's so rewarding. It eventually led to me making a living doing what I love, which is turning TVs off in public places. I actually invented a keychain that does this, and I make a living from it. Life is weird. But the success of TV Be Gone, an open source project, got me invited to my first hacker conference. Unlike the world around us, imagine what it might be like to be surrounded, perhaps somewhat like here, with people almost all of whom do what they love. It's incredibly high. And that was the experience at my first hacker conference. I didn't want it to end, but like all conferences, it did. And I wanted more. And I got it in abundance a few months later at Chaos Communication Camp 2007, a huge outdoor camp near Berlin. And no one knew it at the time, but this was to be the birth of the hackerspace movement. At this point in history, there are only about 50 hackerspaces in the world, mostly in Germany. But all of the elements that would become part of hackerspaces everywhere were already at camp, chaos camp. There was technology, of course, but also art and craft and blinking lights out the wazoo and lasers and people sharing enthusiastically their projects. Teaching, learning, sharing. A great supportive community. And of course, there were great talks and presentations. One talk in particular really hit home for me. Some German hackers talked about how to start your own hackerspace. It was so obvious. I didn't have to wait. None of us had to wait for the next conference. We could have this kind of energy all day, all night, all year round at a hackerspace in my hometown. I wasn't the only one inspired by this. A bunch of us North Americans got together and we talked about this for the duration of camp. We all knew we would start hackerspaces when we got home. And we all did. And we did it the way all hackerspaces are started now. You envision a culture you want to be a part of. You put it out there, which attracts more people and strengthens the culture, which attracts more people, etc. You pick a name, you get a website, you make a logo, you make stickers, you hand out stickers to anyone and everyone, you talk to anyone and everyone, and you don't shut up about it. You meet every Tuesday, and you talk about all the details to make it happen, and you play. Eventually, you then get a space. This worked really well for us at NoiseBridge, the hackerspace I co-founded in San Francisco. We talked about it for about a year and worked out all the details. And when we got our first space, it was incredibly exciting for everyone. We raised $12,000 in 24 hours to pay for rent, and we've never been in debt since. And within weeks, we had enough donations to have a full kitchen, a machine shop, a complete electronics lab, a sewing machine, or a bunch of sewing machines, tables, lamps, chairs. Instantly, we were full of really cool people working on cool projects and sharing them, teaching, learning, and sharing. We had vibrant community. The hackerspaces that were started similarly in other parts of North America, together with the existing hackerspaces established in Europe and together with hackerspaces.org, a networking website that a bunch of us created, this served as examples for the rest of the world. And within a year, there were over 100 new hackerspaces that popped up all over the planet and growing all the time. Whenever I travel, giving talks or whatever, I look up and visit the local hackerspace. And if they want, I give a workshop doing what I love, which is teaching how to solder and how to make cool things with electronics, which for me is really fun. It's all ages, all skill levels, and people just enjoy it. I have so many kits for people to play with, and it's my way of sharing what I love, and it attracts more people to hackerspaces to strengthen the community. Here's a picture of me doing a workshop at a local hackerspace here, right here in Brussels. There are several in the area of Belgium here. Please check that out. I want to share with you some of the projects that I have seen at hackerspaces that all grow from people doing what they love. And like most projects at hackerspaces, they're all totally open source, so people can share and innovate from them. This I found when I was first invited to my first hacker conference. I looked online to see what they were about, and I found this project, which hooked me into the scene forever. The city of Berlin gave access to this building to the Chaos Computer Club, a very well-respected hacker group in Germany. They put a bright light in every window, and they put it under computer control to turn the building into a giant computer screen. They put a bunch of software to control it online that's open source, inviting the whole world to hack on it. It started off with just playing an image on the building, quickly grew so it would play animated sequences and scrolling text, and eventually led to the first two people who called in on their cell phones could play Pong on the building. This is awesome public art. A few people at NoiseBridge decided it would be really cool to have a snapshot of the planet. $250, that's all it took, and 6 weeks later, they put up a balloon into near space and got this picture. They documented it all online, and after hundreds of more balloon launches at hackerspaces around the world, the documentation is now easy enough that high school students can do this totally on their own and win science fairs, which just happened a few months ago. This and other things led to the International Hackerspace Space Program, with the very ambitious goal of a hacker on the moon by the year 2023. Will we make that goal? It doesn't matter. Think of all that will be gained and learned along the way, just like the first space program. Be cool to see. MakerBot is a 3D printer. This all grew from one person at NYC Resistor in New York thinking it would be really cool to have a robot that he made that would make things. And this grew to a very successful 3D printer company. It can print out anything, any object from your imagination into a real thing you can hold in plastic. And they have an online website where anyone can upload and download any object, and they can print it out at a MakerBot or any other 3D printers around. These are cheap enough that every hackerspace pretty much in the world has one, and lots of other people. As well as 3D printers, a lot of hackerspaces have laser cutters, and these are very sophisticated machines. You can cut very intricate precision parts to make sophisticated projects. On the other hand, these few people at Hive 76 in Philadelphia decided they would just make business cards by engraving their company business on thin, dried slices of meat. It was popular enough that a lot of other people wanted. Now they have a company that they do it for other people. This is pretty awesome. Some people at Artisans Asylum in the Boston area thought it would be really cool to ride on top of giant robots. And they're building this thing now. This is 1,800 pounds, and it's big enough to walk over cars. Last year, after the disaster in Fukushima in Japan, people were very dissatisfied with all of the lack of information coming from the Japanese government. So the Tokyo hackerspace made do-it-yourself Geiger counters that they would give away, and people everywhere could measure radiation levels. One problem, however, is that no one knew what normal radiation levels were. So people in hackerspace in L.A. started Safecast, a nonprofit group where they would give away these do-it-yourself Geiger counters to anyone in the world, and it would automatically upload all the radiation information to an open-source database that anyone can use for any purpose for the rest of the Internet, eternity, hopefully. And this is citizen science in action. One of the ways hackerspaces innovate is taking things that have been traditionally up till now been very expensive and making them inexpensive and accessible. I think we're going to be learning more about this later, but BioCurious is a biology hackerspace in the San Francisco area, and people there made an open PCR so that now it's an open source PCR machine that anyone can replicate DNA on their desktop. And finally, this is Code Hero, came out of NoiseBridge. It's a really fun computer game with intense graphics that anyone, any skill level, any age, can play this game, and just by playing it, learn to program and make their own computer games. Well, these are just a few, very few, of the many, many incredible projects that come out of hackerspaces, growing simply by people doing what they love. And there are many things that grow from hackerspaces that can improve your life and improve the lives of people around the world. There are two things that I want to point out that I think are very important. One is that real education happens at hackerspaces. As the education bureaucracies around the world continue to fail us, hackerspaces will continue to fill in more of the void, where people teach because they love teaching, where people learn because they love learning, all geared towards living the life you want to live. And secondly, local economy grows at hackerspaces. Hackerspaces provide supportive community for exploring and doing what you love. And think about it.
If you do what you love, chances are really good other people are going to love it too. And in a capitalist society, if people love what you do, they will pay you to do it. Many companies have grown this way, including mine. And if your company grows and you need help, you can hire from the local community. This creates local economy that works for everyone. The future of economy everywhere is creative, and hackerspaces are a fantastic place to explore your creativity. There are many... Let me say this. I hope you see now that hackerspaces really are cool. And I hope you may want to check one out. There may be one near you. Just simply check online and see. If there's not one near you, start one. It's the only way hackerspaces happen. It's the only way they've ever happened. People like you started them. So get to it. Your hometown needs a hackerspace. And there's no right and wrong way to do it. Just whatever works for you. There's so many ways to do it. I'm going to show you one example that is near and dear to me. NoiseBridge, which I co-founded. We are a nonprofit, consensus decision making. We have one rule and one rule only, which is be excellent to each other. Membership is open to anyone, any age, but you don't need to be a member to do anything at NoiseBridge. You don't need to be a member to take classes. You don't need to be a member to teach classes. You don't need to be a member to use all of our tools. You don't even need to be a member to have a key at NoiseBridge. I happen to have some NoiseBridge keys here, if anyone wants one. See me afterwards and take one. And please use it. I am totally serious. You are always welcome at NoiseBridge. And wherever you go, please look up the local hackerspace. I have a lot of keys. Online. These are the 1,106 hackerspaces that exist now in the world listed on hackerspaces.org. Wherever you go, whenever you travel, please look up and visit the local hackerspace. You are invited to do so. Meet new friends. Explore and create community that works for you. We all need community to thrive in our lives. At hackerspaces around the world, we have found ways of creating community that works. The world is looking to us. At hackerspaces, we have supportive community for exploring what you love. If we choose to do what we love, our lives get better. If we choose to share it with others, the lives of those around us get better. If enough of us do this, the world gets better. It is up to you and you alone what you choose to do with the time of your life. Please choose well.
Amen to that. This is a Carpe Diem episode. I hope it will encourage you to get on and do the things that you want to do, to express your deepest and most creative desires, not to be held back by any type of mental blockages. And we've got Alan Watts to inject a slightly philosophical note into the show at this point.
That what I want, basically, what I really want is what you want. And I don't know what you want. Surprise me. But that's the kinship between I and thou. So when I ask, I go right down to the question, which we started with. What do I want? The answer is, I don't know. When Bodhidharma was asked, who are you? Which is another form of the same question. He said, I don't know. Planting flowers to which the butterflies come. Bodhidharma says, I know not. I don't know what I want. Well, when you don't know what you want, you've reached the state of desirelessness. when you really don't know. You see, there's a beginning stage of not knowing, and there's an ending stage of not knowing. In the beginning stage, you don't know what you want because you haven't thought about it, or you've only thought superficially. Then when somebody forces you to think about it and go through and say, yeah, I think I'd like this, I think I'd like that, I think I'd like the other, that's the middle stage. Then you get beyond that. Say, is that what I really want? In the end you say, no, I don't think that's it. I might be satisfied with it for a while and I wouldn't turn my nose up at it, but it's not really what I want. Why don't you really know what you want? Two reasons that you don't really know what you want. Number one, you have it. Number two, you don't know yourself, because you never can. The Godhead is never an object of its own knowledge. Just as a knife doesn't cut itself, fire doesn't burn itself, light doesn't illumine itself. It's always an endless mystery to itself. I don't know. And this I don't know, uttered in the infinite interior of the spirit, this I don't know is the same thing as I love, I let go, I don't try to force or control. It's the same thing as humility. And so the Upanishads say, if you think that you understand Brahman, you do not understand, and you have yet to be instructed further. If you know that you do not understand, then you truly understand. For the Brahman is unknown to those who know it, and known to those who know it not. And the principle is that any time you, as it were, voluntarily let up control, in other words, cease to cling to yourself, you have an access of power. Because you're wasting energy all the time in self-defense, trying to manage things, trying to force things to conform to your will. The moment you stop doing that, that wasted energy is available. And therefore, you are, in that sense, having that energy available, you are one with the divine principle. You have the energy. When you're trying, however, to act as if you were God, that is to say, you don't trust anybody and you're the dictator and you have to keep everybody in line, you lose the divine energy. Because what you're doing is simply defending yourself. So then, the principle is, the more you give it away, the more it comes back. Now you say, I don't have the courage to give it away. I'm afraid. And you can only overcome that by realizing, you better give it away because there's no way of holding on to it. The meaning of the fact, you see, that everything is dissolving constantly, that we're all falling apart, we're all in a process of constant death, and that the worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes, or it prospers and like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little hour or two is gone. You know, all that Omar Khayyam jazz. You know, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the great globe itself, I, all which it inherit, shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. All falling apart. Everything is. That's the great assistance to you. That fact that everything is in decay is your helper. That is allowing you that you don't have to let go because there's nothing to hold on to. It's achieved for you, in other words, by the process of nature. So once you see that you just don't have a prayer, and it's all washed up, and that you will vanish and leave not a rack behind, and you really get with that, suddenly you find you have the power, this enormous access of energy. But it's not power that came to you because you grabbed it came in entirely the opposite way. And power that comes to you in that opposite way is power with which you can be trusted.
Now, I should refer new listeners at this stage to episode number 523, when Ivan Illich predicts a sudden collapse of the illusion of social power. I suggest that that might be exactly coincident with a mass turning away from the money system in favor of more democratic and more truly representative systems of aligning offers and requests. Now we continue with the following section of an interview of Professor Robert Jensen, and this was broadcast on Latin Waves in June 2015.
We live in a world today where, you know, public discourse has become a tool used to create stories that direct us in a world where we're told, you know, capitalism is the only way to organize our society, for instance, the war can be just and that invasions are righteous. And so there's a lot of things that, unless we are really aware of, you know, how is it that that story is being framed? How is it that that story is being informed? We feel lost. We're deliberately being misguided. Can we talk a little bit about the need for us to not only be able to be curious about our world, but how do we come to that small T truths that connect the dots and help us make a story that makes sense to us, that is in alignment with who we are?
Well, I think your use of the word story is important, because when we think of the news of the day, the events in the world that are important, we should always remember that there's a bigger story behind it. Take one of the examples you used, capitalism. Whatever the story of the day, whatever the news story of the day, whether it's interest rates going up or the budget or taxes or whatever it might be, there's a bigger story behind it. And one of the key elements of that story in the modern world, in the West, in the developed world especially, but essentially everywhere, is that capitalism is a sort of natural state of being. Well, you know, a simple inquiry reveals pretty quickly that's not true. Capitalism is a product of history. It's a product of choices made really over the last two or three centuries. It's not a natural state of affairs. But if you can tell this bigger story always that capitalism is natural, then there's no way to critique it. And the news stories of the day have to be dealt with within that capitalist frame. So always going back and asking, what are these bigger stories being told? You mentioned war and the whole idea of just war. If you look at the contemporary Middle East, where a lot of the stories about conflict are emanating right now, the question of Syria, the idea of bringing peace and stability and justice to Syria is not easy. Let's not be naive about this. But the assumption behind a lot of the news stories is that the West, led by the United States primarily, but including the European nations, even Canada, the assumption is that we make the decisions about what level of violence to use to bring that peace and stability and justice to Syria. There's a sort of larger story about the inherent moral superiority of the West and the right of, therefore, the West to make those decisions. That's the big story we have to contest. So the news of the day is important, but the bigger stories are even, I think, in some ways more important.
When I was thinking about what it means for me to be able to understand the story behind the story, yeah, I often think about, you know, the colonial wound that we all have been born into and that we never speak about. Because if you're in university or if you're in school, sometimes you hear things like, we're in a post-colonial era. And it sounds romantic to think that it's post, that, you know, it's not the same. So what kind of questions should we be asking us when we take this idea that imperialism was something of the past, that colonial power is something of the past, and that we've now transcended or somehow evolved out of that wound of racial?
Yeah, that's a great point, because, of course, the notion of colonialism, you know, the mainly out of Europe, let's say, the colonial powers literally taking control of other parts of the world, especially in the Americas, let's say, the New World. Well, that condition has, of course, changed, and we are post-colonial in some sense. So the countries once ruled by Spain in South America are no longer ruled by Spain. The countries in Africa once ruled by the British or the French or the Germans or the Dutch are no longer ruled by those countries. So in that sense, of course, we are post-colonial. But there's a couple of really important questions you're raising. One is, of course, colonialism was used to describe the direct control, political control, by those European states over the other lands. But although that has changed, the economic relationships are largely unchanged, so that the economies, or the former colonial world, are still very much controlled out of the West, out of Europe, the United States, for instance. So the question of imperialism is not just about, you know, what kind of direct rule a colonial state might use, but it's how the effective sovereignty of a people is controlled, and that can be done economically as well. I think there's an even deeper way in which we've not transcended the colonial mindset, as you put it. One is, remember, when Europeans came, let's just talk about Canada and the United States, North America. When Europeans came, one of the arguments to justify European colonialism was that the land was not being used, that indigenous people, because they weren't exploiting the land in the same way that Europeans understood that, meant that the land was, in a sense, empty. Of course, there were people here, the indigenous people were here, but because they weren't exploiting the resources in the same way Europeans thought they should be, they, in a sense, had no claim. And that colonial mindset about how to exploit the land, the water, and the air, that's still very much with us. In fact, the entire world is basically based at this point on that conception of exploitation of what we typically call nature. In that sense, we're still locked into the colonial mindset no matter where we live. That's an important reminder, I think, of what we're up against and how things can change on the surface and underlying dynamics still can be very much in place.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about the way power becomes axiomatic. You know, it justifies itself, right? It becomes self-justifying. So in the case of Latin America, if you're growing up indigenous, you know, it is assumed that your own destiny to be brought into slavery, you know, reflects your inability, your inferiority to the colonizers, right? And so it becomes this this privilege that builds upon itself, and over time, the wound becomes internalized. So rather than seeing the history of rapacity and the violence, you know, that took place, the genocides and the struggles, all we see is ourselves as the reason for our own demise, for our own wounds, for our own poverty. There is this story that unfolds, and it becomes retold and told. And over time, you know, no one even remembers where the story began. We just know that poor people are poor because they're lazy, or, you know, that's the story that sounds palatable. Yep. To people who want to justify the system of privilege as it exists. So what would you say to those who have been wounded by too many repetitions of that same story of repression and oppression? How do we break out of it?
Yeah, well, that's a great point. And, you know, throughout modern history, people have observed that one of the ways that an oppressor group, whether it's Europeans coming to the Americas or whatever, one of the ways they maintain control is through control of the mind of the oppressed. It's what we, as you point out, we often refer to as internalized oppression, where you start to believe the story of the people who have dominated you. If you think of, you know, some of the key political, social movements of the middle of the 20th century, you know, what we call in the U.S. usually the 60s, this was a central feature. So think about the black liberation struggle in the United States and the assertion that black is beautiful. Well, that was a very real and concrete reminder to people of African descent that white beauty standards were not the only way to understand yourself. And so that black is beautiful for many people literally meant looking in the mirror and remembering that you are beautiful. It may sound trivial in some sense, but it was an important recognition along with more traditional political slogans and policies. Of course, with indigenous people in the United States, and again, I typically speak mostly about the U.S. experience, not knowing Canada as well, but the American Indian movement in the United States, was not just a political movement, you know, arguing for certain kinds of policies. It was a reclaiming of indigenous traditions. In fact, people referred to themselves as traditionals, those who would no longer accept the idea that Indians should become white to achieve their, you know, greatest potential. And that was very much a part of that struggle as well. You can even think about it in feminist terms, that a lot of feminism was helping women understand that men's definition of them was not the only way to understand themselves. So, you know, this is part of the struggle of every movement that tries to challenge what you pointed out is the naturalizing of domination. And by that, I simply mean the fact that every group of people that's ever tried to dominate another group has tried to make that seem natural, as you pointed out. And fighting that kind of seems obvious once you say it, but it's amazing how that naturalizing of domination, as you're pointing out, can kind of weave itself into the way we think about the world, whether we're on top or on the bottom of that particular dynamic.
You know, I was reading in your book, and you write, we are most free when we are most bound to others. Can you talk a little bit about what this means for you and this idea that the struggle out of this colonized mind, this internalized oppression, it's entangled, it's intertwined with all of us.
Yeah. Well, that's probably one of the most important realizations I think we can come to in the modern world that's defined especially by a capitalist notion of what it means to be a person. And that's another important point, that, you know, behind every political philosophy, every political movement, there's a sense of what it means to be a person, what it means to be human. And in contemporary America, defined by corporate capitalism and mass consumption, you know, people are thought of as being individuals, discrete and completely independent. And in that conception, you are part of a society only to the degree you choose to do it. Your identity is as an individual. Well, that's a very idiosyncratic way of thinking about being human, very modern. For most of human history, people really didn't think of themselves primarily as individuals, but as part of groups. Your identity came from your place, going back to hunting and gathering societies, your place in a band-level society, you know, society that probably had no more than 50 to 150 people in it. Well, that's dramatically different than this individual, this obsession with the individual we have in the modern world. So when I wrote, we have to realize we are most free when we are most bound to others, it's a challenge to that notion that freedom is in independence, in your separation from others. No human being's life makes any sense separate. We aren't separate. We are social beings. And we get a lot of our sense of ourselves from the surroundings, from not only our social group, but also our place in the larger natural world. And so freedom doesn't come when you're detached from people. Freedom comes from, in my point of view, from understanding your relationship, again, not only to other people, but to that larger living world. And for me personally, who, you know, someone who grew up with that very intense sense of individualism, it was a real struggle to recognize that the key is to human life isn't independence, it's a recognition of interdependence with others and with what we tend to call nature.
I was thinking about, you know, this interconnectedness and this desire to be in community and how painful exile can be. And I wonder if you could talk, because you've written extensively on, you know, the way the violence against women has also become naturalized. And so for me, the question is also, how do we create spaces that are both bounded, but at the same time, recognize the inherent value of each person, the uniqueness and beauty that each brings to the whole. And the reason I ask you this question is because as a woman, you are raised to care for everybody. You are raised to be the caregiver, you know. And so there's a lot of oppression that has been naturalized, and that I feel this sentence taken by itself could be taken to naturalize that process. You know, women are the birthers of, you know, life, and so they should do all the housework and they should care for all the children. And so it becomes this naturalized story that's the culture. That's our culture. We're people who do everything as a group, and so that's the role of the women. How do you speak to your female students who see this call to be bonded and at the same time want to create some spaces where possibilities can emerge for women.
Right. Well, let's go back, because I think these two questions are related. First, to that notion about recognizing our interdependence doesn't mean we're all, you know, clones of each other, that we're somehow just kind of robots and identical. One feminist philosopher I'm fond of many years ago wrote an essay where she talked about the struggle for individuality without individualism. And by that, she meant the kind of honoring of individual differences that you're talking about, because, of course, we all are distinct and different, and we all bring different kind of qualities to the common life. And so we don't want to erase individuality. We don't want to erase individual variation among human beings. It would be a pretty boring world if we did that. It's this obsession with individualism, this assertion that we are first and foremost separate, that we're trying to challenge, not the idea that people are different. Obviously, people are different, and that's a good thing. So this struggle, I think, is encapsulated very nicely in this phrase, the search for individuality without individualism. Now, the way that plays out in gender, you know, it's an interesting story that patriarchy tells, especially versions of patriarchy, I think, that are rooted in religious ideas. Because if you look at that argument that comes from more traditional religious sectors, they claim that both men and women, both husband and wife in the traditional family that they always value, both of them have obligations, right? The man is the head of the household, and he has obligations to provide, to lead, to guide, you know, and the woman has different obligations to care for the household and all sorts of things. And first of all, we recognize that because there is that individuality, that you can't typecast people so easily. You can't say all men fit this role and all women fit that role, because there's individual variation. It really is rather stifling when you have no choice in the way that you live your life like that. But the other thing is, of course, if you put men in that role and say they have obligations, but you give them all the power to decide, well, the obligations are not going to play out equally, as you're pointing out. And men are naturally, I think, when given that kind of power, going to gravitate toward the misuse of that power, just as any group of human beings given a kind of unnatural power over others in this sense is likely to abuse it. So what we learn is that, you know, from this example, I think what we learn is that, you know, being human is difficult. It's a struggle. We are individual, yet we are part of a group. We want to fit into roles in a society that help make society stable, but those roles can be stifling. So there's got to be flexibility and creativity in them. I mean, all of this is just a reminder that, you know, being human and having the big brain and having the capacity that we're exhibiting right here, the ability to, you know, have a conversation that's linguistically complex and intellectually complex, that's all very exciting. It also makes life hard sometimes, and that's what we have to struggle with. But the answer is in the struggle, not in pretending this is all very simple, as traditional religion, for instance, wants to do.
Now, for one last perspective on the desperation, which is modern American life, we hear from Morris Berman. This is an interview in 2014 by Judith Regan after he'd published his book Spinning Straw into Gold, Straight Talk for Troubled Times.
Americans are really suffering. They're really, really hurting. They're angry and anxious and depressed, and there's a lot of pain really close to the surface. And frankly, I don't go online in a single day where I don't find that some shooting has occurred in the United States. You know, and it's not, you know, curiously enough, I'm with the NRA on this. I don't think it's guns. If we're so unhappy that if we were not blowing each other out of the water with guns, we'd be carving each other up with knives.
Yeah.
That's how bad things have gotten. And there's a kind of thing that I believe personally, that if you have a culture that is based on inauthenticity, which is what I feel our culture is about. So, you know, Kim Kardashian's tushy or Miley Cyrus's tongue are actually topics of discussion and for people to get excited about. A culture that's so soaking in authenticity makes people crazy because they can't live their real lives. And that's what success is defined as in the United States. And people are constantly chasing the American dream, and the result is that they're sick as dogs. You know, George Carlin, may God rest his soul,
once remarked, they call it the American dream because you got to be asleep to believe it.
And that's the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. How would one define the American dream today?
Well, there are a number of characteristics. In one of the books I wrote about 3 or 4 years ago, it's called A Question of Values, and it's a collection of essays, and half of those essays are about life in the United States. And one of them talks about what I call unconscious programming in America that goes back hundreds of years, and it's why we can't seem to step out of what we're doing. And you hear that unconscious programming coming out of the mouth of the president or just people in their daily conversation. And these include things like we're the chosen people, which is frequently called American exceptionalism, for example. Another one is extreme individualism. You can and should do it by yourself. You're Clint Eastwood, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real formula to make people sick. No community at all. And then one of the other ones that I think relates to the American dream in particular is the notion of an endless frontier. And historians have written volumes and volumes about this. It started out with the historian Frederick Jackson Turner in 1893, who gave a talk at the American Historical Association called The Endless Frontier in American History, in which he basically said that in 1890, the census, the U.S. Bureau of Census, closed the geographical frontier. It said we had filled out the United States. But there was always a technological frontier or an economic frontier known as imperialism, or a psychological frontier. And so the idea is to always be expanding such that the goal of any American is simply more.
Right.
You know, there's a film, Key Largo, with Edward G. Robinson and Humphrey Bogart, obviously from many years ago, in which Edward G. Robinson plays the gangster and Humphrey Bogart, of course, plays the good guy. And he confronts Edward G., the crook, and he says, "What is it you want? Do you know what you want?" And Edward G. Robinson says, "Yes, I do. More." The problem with it is once you get more, then there's more.
Right.
So finally, you've got, what is John McCain owned 13 houses? At one point, he lost track of the number of properties he actually had. How? I don't get it. Is he going to get cloned 12 times?
Right.
So he can live in each of those houses simultaneously? I mean, what people, all the studies that have been done worldwide, not just America, but worldwide on happiness have indicated that once you've covered the basics, having more doesn't increase your happiness.
Right.
It lies somewhere else. And yet, you know, when Thomas Jefferson wrote Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, everybody, those were code words in the 18th century, everybody understood that pursuit of happiness meant pursuit of property. And all the founding fathers died wealthy. You know, I mean, they did it. I mean, George Washington had something like, you know, died with $2 million, which today would be about...
$2 billion.
Yeah, $2 billion, I mean, you know, something mm-hmm. like that. You know, and, but that was how they saw the world, and that's what they imparted to Americans, that it's every man or woman for themselves, but
yep.
the idea is to maximize what you own. Well, I don't know how many cars I can drive simultaneously, how many suits I can wear simultaneously. You know, finally, it's all just symbolic stuff, and it definitely doesn't increase your enjoyment in life. I mean, that was why I wrote a book with the epigraph is from the British Victorian social reformer.
John Ruskin.
Yeah, you know, there is no wealth but life. You know,
that is true wealth.
Yeah, I mean, what is the quality of your life? It's getting another Mercedes-Benz is not going to do it.
Yeah. Well, so the American dream, which is wrapped up in this materialistic orgy, one of the things we have to look at is at what expense to others, aside from the fact that it gives your life no meaning to have 12 houses, aside from that fact, what is the price that others have to pay for you to acquire all of this stuff for yourself? We're looking at this now in terms of the environment, in terms of world economics, in terms of so much. You know, what is the end game of capitalism if we keep going like this?
Yeah, you just spot on. I mean, you just hit the mark there. There was a film with Jeremy Irons a couple of years ago called Margin Call, which was about the crash of 2008 and basically how these people were living. And at the end, Jeremy Irons gives a talk and he says, there is no point. It's just accumulation for the sake of accumulation. And of course, the thing that hovers around this are the things you just mentioned. One is, environmentally speaking, the problem with the American dream or any concept of endless frontier is that there is no such thing as infinite acquisition in a finite world. I mean, we will run out of oil. That will happen down the road. And frankly, I'm just looking around in my house. I see a pen or a plate or a book cover. Those are all made out of petroleum. You know, I mean, that's where it comes. Where, you know, so what is it we're going to do when we really run out of that? That's one thing, an environmental question. But the other thing is that, I mean, you can't tell me that the poverty in the third world is unrelated to the wealth in the first world. Even when you have a situation where 1% of the American population owns 47% of the wealth or something like that within the nation, and just recently reading the statistics that the wealthiest 400 individuals in the United States have wealth equivalent to the bottom 180 million. I mean, it's curious to use a phrase bottom 180 million.
But
400 people have the wealth of more, you know, like 60% of the country. So it's a very bizarre and sick kind of arrangement. But finally, when you think of the cost to the third world, that something like 2 billion people live on less than a dollar a day and 3 billion less than $2 a day, and what life must be like when your water is, you know, contaminated and basically you watch people around you starve, and what's going on in the first world that's producing that, we have set things up from a long time ago that free trade really means we exploit the third world for our benefit.
Yeah. Well, if you just do a study of Walmart and the billions and billions in profit that they have every year off the backs of people who are manufacturing the goods very often in third world countries that have all these issues, and also their very workers, you know, whom they pay in a very meager way. A lot of them are part-time employees with no benefits. And the government has to subsidize their economic lives because they can't afford to eat.
That's right.
And yet
right.
The family is making $17 billion a year in profit. I mean, yeah. that's when you look at the equation and say, what's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, and
I mean, what does this mean? And how does that give any of these people meaning?
Right. I mean, that's why I said that the money after a certain point becomes symbolic.
Right. So how does one justify it off of the backs of so many to create such human suffering?
That's not a problem. That's not a problem for the wealthy in the United States or elsewhere. Basically, the ideology is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness means that there is no ultimate end to wealth, and the good life is that each of us has the opportunity to expand our resources indefinitely and go ahead and do it. That's the American dream. Of course, it ignores the fact that the playing field isn't even, and most people are not starting off with those types of opportunities that make it possible. And so finally, ask anybody in the Tea Party or the GOP for that matter. I mean, basically, they really feel that the redistribution of wealth is theft. And a healthy life is that everybody, you know, gets a chance to roll the dice and pursue their dream. And so anything like redistribution or consideration of other issues to them, it's not a surprise to me that Alan Greenspan was a protege of Ayn Rand. You know, that's not a surprise to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What's the solution? You have a lot of people who are out there listening to this show. They probably share these views or may not share these views, and I'm sure a lot of them know that there's gross inequality. They feel that there's no family life, community life, tradition. They may be working for corporations that create a situation that's do or die, and if you don't meet your numbers and go along with the agenda and sell the antidepressants and push these stupid electronic cigarettes and, you know, get people to drink Coca-Cola, if you don't do your job, you're out on the street starving, your children are starving, and...
Sure.
So they stay on that conveyor belt, even though they may feel that it's an inauthentic life, even though they may feel that it's not quite right, but they don't know what to do.
Right.
People feel
right.
trapped by the circumstances of their lives. So what do you say to them?
Well, the first thing is that in terms of solutions, we should talk about they're solutions that are real in the sense that they're, if you recognize everything that you just said, Judith, if we recognize that, and we say, well, then the problems are structural, then the only, I mean, sociologically, the only way to solve structural problems is with structural solutions. And then we have to say, okay, leaving the individual solutions aside for a moment, just looking at social solutions, what's available? Well, one is armed revolution, which is a good path to take if you enjoy chewing on steel, you know. Mm-hmm. Another one is the belief that, which I don't think is going to work, that if you elect the right people, somehow they're going to institute a different type of regime. Everybody believed that about Obama in 2008, and look what a complete failure he was. He never has his friends are the rich, and that's who he's, you know, passing the money along to. So it's that 60s graffito that went, if elections could change the system, they would be declared illegal. You know, we have to really grasp it and understand that going to the voting booth is not about changing the system. And so if those things structurally are really impossible and you say, well, there is no way of changing the larger machinery, then dealing with on the social or large political level, what has to happen, in my view, is that this scenario has to play out. In other words, I think there may be hope, but we're talking several decades down the line, let's say 30 or 40 years, and we're talking that we have to get to a point where the system implodes. Now, it's doing that in a slow motion way right now. It is imploding. We have a national debt of more than $17 trillion. I mean, think about that. In a few years, the interest on the national debt will be about $1 trillion a year, the interest
right,
on it.
Right.
So, I mean, the system is imploding. China and Japan hold $3 trillion in U.S. securities. All they have to do is pull the plug, and we'd be finished. They don't do that because they want to get their money back, but, you know, they could do it if they wanted. And we're in a situation where it's no longer viable. What will happen on the far side of that is what I talk about. And what I talk about, again, these are not individual solutions, but structural ones. What I talk about is what I call dual process. In other words, not so much in the United States, a bit, but especially in Europe, there's a lot going on in Japan, of alternative systems, alternative currency systems, alternative energy systems. People are exploring ways of living outside of the mainstream economic system. Spain alone has something like 325 alternative currency experiments going on. 325.
Right.
It's happening. Yeah. So, I mean, what's happening is that by the phrase dual process, what I mean is that as this system disintegrates, there is the emergence of a kind of shadow political formation that's getting stronger and stronger and is saying, we have to talk in terms of what really makes people happy, and it's not having billions of dollars. And therefore, we have to talk about ways of living outside of the dominant culture as the dominant culture collapses. That, I think, is going to happen. You know, just as the Middle Ages finally eroded and disintegrated and gave rise to capitalism.
It's interesting. Have you seen the Hunger Games movies?
Yes, I have. I have.
Okay. I don't really think that's far off from here.
Oh, no.
I mean,
no.
It's a perfect metaphor for the way we're living.
Right. And not far off also. Although it was projected as 500 years, I thought it was about 20 away, is a wonderful film called Idiocracy. I don't know if you've seen that.
No.
Oh, you have to run out and get the DVD immediately. But, I mean, it's basically the total moronization of the culture, you know. The Hunger Games really said it, that this is not far off, and this is what the implosion I'm talking about. And so people, especially in Europe, are getting very creative with alternatives that are going to preserve the environment. Even the United States, for example, there are secessionist movements afoot. I gave the keynote address a year and a half ago at the annual secessionist conference in Vermont. There's a very vibrant secessionist movement in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the United States will break up geopolitically, and I think that these experiments, especially in other places that are really accelerating now, will happen. So that would be, you know, the solution. However, to answer your original question, well, what do I say to somebody who says, oh, that's fine, but you're talking 40 years down the line. What about right now? How am I going to live right now? And that's why in this book, Spinning Straw into Gold, I say, you know, success
is living in reality. It's not the American dream, and it's not when your ship is going to come in. That ship will never come in. So you've got to live in reality right now. And then going back to the Twilight book and our previous interview, in that book I talk about what I call the new monastic option. In other words, you withdraw to some extent from society and you dedicate yourself to the preservation of what's the best in American civilization. There are all kinds of ways to do that, but you will not be happy without a rich inner life.
Exactly.
And since you cannot change the overall configuration, I mean, it wasn't even an attempt, really, but Occupy Wall Street was the latest, attempt to say, we need a different type of system. And frankly, it collapsed like a limp noodle. I mean, they had no political platform. They had no political organization. It went nowhere, and that's what you would expect. And so finally, there is no turning around of this system. It does have to disintegrate.
Right, right. And in the meantime, don't be running around buying a bunch of stuff. Develop a rich inner life, as you say in your book, Spinning Straw into Gold. What about the, I would say, ambiguous role of technology in all of this?
Well, it got to a point, I would say around 1920 or 1930, where we didn't really need any more of it. In other words, medical advances, the technology of medical advances are so specialized, like heart transplants, for example. Very few people can afford these things. If we had just stopped with all that stuff and instead say, how do we extend medical care to everybody in the country? That's a social technology. And that would be much better than a literal, physical, technical technology to do. We are in a situation now where, thanks to screens, there's been a lot of study of the impact of screens on the human brain, and especially it's affecting young people because they were brought up in that culture. It actually affects the synaptic connections in the brain. And it's making those screens are making people dumber and dumber by the year. People can't read. When they read online with ebooks or Kindle, what happens is they scan. It's not the kind of thing where you go into yourself and figure out who you are as opposed to the protagonist of a novel or something like that. One is just scanning with stuff on virtual reality. And so one thing after another, we had reached a point where technology was serving our needs, and yet that's the endless frontier, you see. Why do we need 47 varieties of razor blades? Two would be enough.
Right.
That there's no end to what you can do with this. And then finally, of course, you get the NSA and spying and surveillance, the technology, that thin thread program that they developed so that they can trace words like Occupy, for example, through literally billions of emails and then identify you as somebody who is a dissenter or a problem, potential troublemaker. And so that's a great use of technology. What happened to the land of the free?
Morris, I got a call this week from a banker at JP Morgan Chase, where I have a checking account. A checking account. They wanted me to answer so many personal questions, and they said they have been tasked now to go to all of their clients and ask all this personal information. He literally asked me where I got the money. I'm 60 years old. I've run a very successful publishing company for many years.
I'd like you to bring that publishing company back, by the way.
I have just announced that I'm bringing it back.
I've got a book for you.
Well, there you go. There's a reason you came on the show today.
Judith, we have to talk.
Seriously,
I wrote my agent just 2 days ago. I wrote my agent. I said, look, I'm about to do this thing with Judith Reagan. I'm very much looking forward to it. What happened to her publishing company? He wrote back and he says, as far as I know, it doesn't exist anymore. Meanwhile, he's shopping. I just wrote a book on Japan and he's shopping it around.
Well, tell him.
You're alive and well.
I am alive and well, and he can contact me through my producer. I don't want to give out my email.
I'll send it to James.
Yeah, send it to James. Your agent's information. No, I'm starting a new publishing company. I'm coming back. I am doing new, innovative, interesting things.
Yeah, you were doing good books.
Yeah, and life matters. It matters. We're doing some good stuff, and I'm looking forward to your proposal.
That's terrific.
Back to technology, what about the internet? Is there any upside just in terms of linking people in some important way to share ideas, because there, you know, if you study the internet, it's a little bit of everything because it's just a technological tool. But so much has been revealed about human nature and the dark side and the hateful side and the pornographic side, and it seems to get all of the heat and all of the attention.
Speaking of the pornographic side, the stats are that 94% of internet use is for pornography.
I'm not surprised.
94. You know, I mean, so we have 6% that could be considered intelligent until you go online and see what that 6% is.
They're following Justin Bieber.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is where the American head is thanks to this technology.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, look, it's great for me because I live in Mexico, and if I didn't have the net, in order to do the research, you know, every 3 months I would have to come up to Austin and use the University of Texas library and all that. I don't have to do that. I can do it all online. I have access to all that. It's wonderful. I also run a blog. All of 132 people are registered in a nation of 315 million, but that's fine. I mean, we have great discussions on the blog and frankly, but I wouldn't kid myself that it constitutes a true family. Virtual connections are not ultimately real connections. Real connections consist of the human body.
Yeah.
You know, that somebody, you are in a room with other bodies. And all this excitement that went down with Arab Spring. Where's Arab Spring now? You know, I mean, this cannot happen on the basis of virtual reality. It's just virtual.
Right.
And the tendency in the United States, in the book I wrote before Spinning Straw, it was the third in the Empire, American Empire series. It's called Why America Failed. I have a whole chapter called The Illusion of Progress, which is about technology as America's hidden religion. And we worship this stuff.
Oh, I know.
You know, it doesn't matter if it's a moonshot or the Erie Canal or, you know, the latest PlayStation. We worship this stuff, and we see that as solutions. I was at an airport a few months ago. It was a Wired magazine, I can't remember. There was an interview with Bill Gates, and then I think another one with Obama. I think I'm correct about that. But both of them were saying technology is the answer. This is what Americans believe. How long of technology being destructive does that have to happen for you finally to turn around and say, you know, we've gotten to the point that technology is the problem and not the solution?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not going to happen in the United States because, I mean, one thing I talk about in these books is the brainwashing is extremely powerful. And when I say one of the major problems in the United States is that Americans are stupid, I don't mean just in terms of IQ. Robert McNamara had one of the highest IQs in the history of the world. He may have been the dumbest guy on the planet while he was alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is not a question of, well, you were born in the ghetto and you're ignorant or something like that. I mean, how do you say that Dick Cheney is intelligent? You know, what a joke that is.
Yeah. So where do we go from here? We have a rich inner life. You did it. You went to Mexico. Tell me what you did.
Well, I didn't have I have to be quite candid here and admit that I didn't have the inner strength to resist the culture. I wanted to. I very much. I was living in Washington, D.C., which is the worst of the worst. I don't know if you've seen that series House of Cards.
Oh, yeah.
Boy, is that accurate.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Right on. And my notion was that I was going to be a lotus in a cesspool. And what happened was, after 8 years in Washington, I was just a dirty lotus. My plan didn't succeed, and I was getting spiritually sicker by the day. And finally, I realized that the only way for me to escape the categories of the American value system was to escape America. Because as long as I was immersed in it on a daily basis, and I was watching TV and I was hearing about Claritin and Lunesta and one bit of nonsense after another. And as long as I was immersed in that, I was not going to heal. I was not going to improve. And I saw that. I saw that. I saw what the rest of my life would be like. And so I left. And the first year was just, which was 2006-07, was just chilling out. It was just decompressing from this corporate commercial wraparound culture that gets you by the throat so you can't breathe anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a chilling out. I mean, I live in a small town. You know, I mean, it's just quite quiet. And then, starting in 2007, I wrote 5 books in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
they just fell out of me, right, including spinning straw into gold. They just literally fell out of me. And it was like they were effortless. And that's what happens when you don't have all that noise in your head. And
you develop clarity.
Yeah. You just sit in the stillness. And you know what? Stuff emerges on its own.
It does.
It just emerges on its own. I wrote Spinning Straw into Gold in 24 hours.
Amazing.
I never imagined it would happen. I was staying with a friend in Mexico City. She actually was traveling. She wasn't there. But I had the key to her apartment. I sat down in my favorite chair. It's this really comfortable chair. I didn't get up except to go to the bathroom for 24 hours. That comes about by this endless pressure being removed. Because if what we're really on this earth to do is to spin straw into gold, it's really finally to be creative and to give that to the culture, then in order to do that, you can't be living somebody else's life.
Now, as an antidote to the techno-skepticism of Maurice Berman, I present a young British man, a new speaker on the show, Mr. Chris Larkham, who spent several years working on a piece of software. I believe it's still under development. It's called NoMap. It aims to align people's requests and offers in order to help them realize their visions, a moneyless operating system for Gaia, therefore free of the various corruptions of institutionalized wealth. He's made a conscious effort in its design to try to align the technology with how humans like to operate. I've just discovered him through the wonders of the internet, which even Maurice Berman admits has its finer points. Such synchronicity is definitely one of them. This is an audio which I found and then rethought my decision. I was going to take a holiday. I thought, no, this matches my own ambitions so much. I think I need to put this on the show and get it out there. Now, I've trimmed it slightly to clean up the audio and to fit in the time available.
I guess it really began when I was about 22 years old, right between my master's degree and PhD. So I'd spent a year of intensely studying a topic which was an interdisciplinary topic called evolutionary and adaptive systems, which is systems theory and studying natural adaptive systems, looking at nature and how it's organized or self-organized. And then how can we learn from nature to create adaptive and intelligent technologies? So it was partly science and partly engineering. And that gave me a different way of looking at things, a more non-linear whole systems way of looking at things. And the way I was perceiving the world after that was different to the way I was perceiving the world before it. So that master's degree was quite unusual. And I think all of the people on the course were quite affected by it positively. But it was really after that. And I experienced a really profound spiritual awakening. And it was, I would say, catalyzed by LSD festival. And it was almost like a rebirth experience for me. And at that point, everything shifted. And I went from being quite agnostic, really. I had been sort of identified with atheism, but I moved into an agnostic space. And then I had this spiritual experience and I went back to a kind of spiritual space where I integrated science with spirituality through, I guess, geometry. So I had this transcendent experience where my sense of self changed, and I felt as though, well, it was more in the feeling, it was a knowing that I was everyone, and I guess my ego really took a kind of back seat. Basically, I could see that all religions were pointing to a transcendent or transcendental truth or reality beyond the words, beyond the metaphor. Somehow, all the religions were pointing to something that is ontologically real, an experience of higher or expanded consciousness. And as a scientist, and I was very much in the scientific reality at the time, I couldn't deny what I was experiencing because it was a direct knowing. And I thought to myself, you know, how can I take this back with me? And the only language I could really use was sort of based on geometry. So at that point, I kind of rewired my nervous system and my journey really began. I'm interested in psychedelics, but it's kind of still semi-taboo to discuss it in the Western culture, but that's now changing with research. You know, not everyone experiences a spiritual or religious experience, but it certainly happens and it's, you know, well documented. But the map is not the territory. Really, the territory I experienced that day transformed me, and in my life was not the same from that point, and I never looked back. And it really, like, I kind of began a mission of, you know, because I could see it was almost like everyone was kind of somehow outside of the now, and it seemed as though everyone was seeking something like that's in the future. And I felt as though if we could communicate that scientifically, maybe we could create a different experience on the earth that was more joyful and peaceful. But after, should I carry on what happened after
Let me just ask a question about what happened. So you've had this awakening, which is really happening to many people, and I think it's really important stories that we share, our stories of awakening, because it's like we crack open the veils and we see through the limitations of the programming, so to speak, and we open ourselves up to new realities and new ways of seeing, which is so perfect given your background. You're studying epigenetics and
I experienced a higher level of synchronicity than normal, and that really led me to question the fundamental beliefs I had about physics and the way the world operates. Mm-hmm. And also, like, you know, what is enlightenment? I experienced a sort of temporary enlightened state, so I began an investigation. I read every book I could, I was on the internet, and then I went into my PhD, you know, having had that experience. So I was now doing kind of two things, really. My PhD, which was really pursuing my curiosity and interest in AI, artificial intelligence, and consciousness, because I've always been fascinated by consciousness. And it was really my way of trying to understand what I am. What is this? Why are we here? Answering these big philosophical questions. For me, AI was my way of doing that, synthetic methodology. So I was pursuing that. But simultaneously, I was experimenting on my own consciousness, and I began to experiment with different psychedelics. So I was really doing it for self-exploration and to understand, you know, what this is about, you know, what is possible. And so I was studying consciousness from the inside and the outside simultaneously. And I think that enabled me to find a kind of balance between the objective and subjective. I had a fair amount of free time or flexible amount of time during the PhD. And I then watched every documentary I could online. And I had access to, you know, the internet, obviously, and the library at the university. And I came across works by Abraham Maslow and Timothy Leary, Terence McKenna. And, you know, these people were really important to me at the time because they made sense of what I was experiencing in a way that most authors somehow couldn't. And I know that Barbara Marx Hubbard, her influences, the people she feels have touched her deeply are very, they're the same set of people pretty much, including Adair Chardin and Abraham Maslow. And it felt as though there were a small set of people who had ventured into this new space of conscious experience and mapped that territory. And I was sort of seeing them as, you know, transcendentalists, I guess you could say. So it's they ventured into a larger territory of human consciousness or transhuman consciousness. And then I just really felt as though then what happened is I got drawn into an activist reality, and I was temporarily interacting with the Zeitgeist movement, and I helped screen the film a few times. And I really could feel the pain of the of humanity and the earth, because humanity is part of the earth. And I could see, based on studying the scientific data available, that our hydrocarbon-based society is completely unsustainable, and perhaps that's a good thing because it's painful to be in this reality of consumption and disconnection and separation. So I felt as though basically if humanity was to survive another 10 or 20 years, I think 20 being optimistic, 10 being safe, we had to radically change our trajectory. And by trajectory, I mean the basic way we think, perceive, interact, how we deal with technology, how we relate to each other, everything. And I was looking at it from a whole systems perspective because of my background. And I felt as though this kind of reductionist, purely left brain cognition way of thinking, way of perceiving was actually intrinsic to the problem in the first place, part of the problem. So it's, as Einstein says, we would need to change our thinking to solve the problems, because it's, you can't solve problems with the same kind of thinking that created them. So here I was on the internet experimenting with my consciousness in my spare time and on the internet watching all these documentaries, and I felt really I had to do something, because I was in a unique position to do something, and I felt it, I just felt like, well, if not me, then who? And if not now, then when? And who else is doing anything? And I felt as though I saw one possibility for one probable future reality that we could co-create to escape this kind of entropic consumption paradigm. And that was really inspired through the resource-based economy concept and the Venus Project, which is quite technocratic, but the essence of it for me was sharing and symbiosis, and I resonated with that on a deep level, and I felt as though it complements nature's natural operating system of self-organizing ecosystems, that it's win-win symbiosis. And so it's really sharing and having it's moneyless. It's going beyond money and sharing resources in a way that is optimal in reference to our natural sort of biological homeostasis. So we would optimize the life support systems to minimize labor, to maximize health and well-being, not just for human beings, but for the whole biosphere. So I decided that I would put energy into creating that, because it felt to me as though the money system and the economy was the big thing holding us back, because all of the pieces of the puzzle seem to be there. The solutions are there, and they were there when I started this 4 years ago. But I felt like, how can we bring them together? How can we bring those pieces of the puzzle together, make them visible, give energy to them and create them? How can we do that in this economy, in this socioeconomic system, in this way of thinking? And it seemed as though what needed to change was the way of thinking, the worldview, and then the socioeconomic system. So I started a project called SERBE, which stands for Scalable Resource-Based Economy. That was what became NewMap. And I ended up spending more and more time on this idea until I got to the point where I could no longer stay in academia, and I began to realize how the system itself really, and the way of thinking that goes with that is what's holding us back. And I felt more and more inhibited and held back by the academic system, and I became completely disillusioned with the academic system and began to discover that the world was far stranger than I ever imagined, and that basically I felt quite angry, as though I'd been lied to about everything. And I think I went more and more down the rabbit hole, and each step I took, I feel I took carefully and following a scientific method, but expanding my concept and understanding of science and ontology to include consciousness and the subjective felt direct experience at the moment, which to me is now fundamental. And things got quite cosmic, basically. But I still feel like I am a rational being, and I look at observational evidence, and I consider other people's opinions, and I have an intention not to cling to any particular belief systems. And I like to take in as much information as I can. And so I understand that some of the things I say are controversial, but for me, it's always been a rational journey. A trans-rational journey, but not irrational. Mm-hmm.
I want to just jump in with a few comments. So, like when you were saying how continuing to watch those assumptions about what's true, I'm reminded of David Bohm's work as a quantum physicist in the peak of his field. He was deeply influenced by Krishnamurti, and he devoted himself to, like, what would it take to change consciousness? And he felt that it would be in dialogue spaces where people would let their egos and their assumptions about reality go, so that then they would step into a really, truly generative field, which would be the quantum field of infinite potential. Okay. So I love hearing how you are in the rational and the transrational and cosmic. It's like such a beautiful, it feels to me very whole. You feel like that feels like a whole being to me when you describe yourself in that way. And, you know, I'm also reminded of Buckminster Fuller's quote about not being victims of our circumstances, but architects of our future. And the work, what the choices that you made, you, even with feeling the kind of the pain of the suffering that's happening on our planet in so many ways, that to choose to create. So I just really want to honor you for that and that courage and the devotion, because I believe that those are the ingredients that it takes for everyone to bring their gifts fully forward, which I really see you doing, bringing your gifts forward. I want to read a beautiful quote from Peter Russell about toward a global brain and use that as a stepping off point into NUMAP. And just then we can dive in. So this is Peter Russell from his book, Toward a Global Brain. The internet will be able to form new associations, synthesize information, creating new knowledge, and perhaps solve problems presented to it. There we go, that AI. It will then have become a system that can learn and think for itself. The changes this will bring will be so great that their full impact may well be beyond our imagination, for some. No longer will we perceive ourselves as isolated individuals. We will know ourselves to be part of a rapidly integrating global network, the nerve cells of an awakening global brain. That quote, I know, must have some resonance for you and in the work that you, your studies, and then in what you've been creating with NUMAP, a new way of mapping the planet from a whole system perspective, because we don't really get to see what's most important or what's the most relevant information. Maybe just use that as a starting point into, like, what is NUMAP? What's its fundamental sort of basis, so we can define some of those terms? And then let's dive in.
Yeah, sure. So so that's, I love that quote. And the association with the global brain is very relevant to NUMAP. NUMAP in itself, really, I sort of tend to make a distinction between the technology and the application of it. So the application of it is just as important as the raw what it is. But what it is, really, NUMAP is a communication technology, and it's based on the concept of a holon. So a holon means whole and a part, something that's simultaneously a whole and a part. And through NUMAP, it's possible to map our perception of energy as holons. So you can have a holon containing a holon containing a holon, and it has this Russian doll fractal geometry. And for me, a holon, it also relates to the concept of a system. Again, back to the systems theory, the whole systems thinking, that everything can affect and is associated and linked to everything else. To me, the holon is the essential core geometry behind the concept or word system. So it's also a slightly stealthy way of bringing bringing systems thinking to a wider audience through NUMAP. So by using NUMAP, it kind of helps you think in systems, because of the holon being the fundamental thing behind a system. So a system, what is a system? System is observer dependent, and you can say, this system contains subsystems, and these subsystems contain subsubsystems, and this system is contained in a supersystem. And that really, the thing that's going on there is you've got this nested structure. So the holon captures that. So then we have a whole new form of media when we start to map perception or energy using holons. So really, NUMAP is delivering a new form of media, and I call that a holonic map, or you could call it a holonomic map as well. And you could think of it as mapping thoughts and things, but I tend to really look at it as we're mapping our perception. So it's really our consciousness that we're mapping, and also the activity of the nervous system. And this is what leads into the global brain association, because if we're collectively mapping on our consciousness, our perception, our experience, then we're also collectively mapping our nervous system. So from a planetary perspective, you could see the nervous system of humanity, the collective nervous system of humanity, as the nervous system of the Earth. And the term noosphere there's several definitions. One of them is the mental layer, a sheath of mental or a thinking layer around the Earth. So the mind of the Earth. And so humanity's nervous system is the nervous system of the Earth. And as we become conscious of that, we begin to create a conscious noosphere, not just a noosphere. We already have a noosphere, but we're going to have a self-conscious noosphere that thinks of itself as the noosphere. And as I'm actually saying this now, I'm actually creating that truth, creating that reality, becoming conscious that I'm not just an individual, but I am the Earth thinking through this particular Gaia cell, if that makes sense.
So as a Gaia cell, so I just want people to really get this, because everyone uses the internet, everyone. And right now we think, this is as good as it gets. This is good. This is good. I get to communicate, and I can talk to people anywhere, and I can do voice over IP, and I have my little Facebook account, and I have a Twitter, and I'm on LinkedIn, and we've got all these little isolated kind of communities everywhere, and from a certain vantage point, it looks pretty good, except we don't see ourselves as part of the larger whole. So if that worldview of fragmentation that we kind of alluded to is operating, then what does that actually mean in terms of our ability to be compassionate, or I don't see myself as connected to these others, but that I don't even recognize that we're one, or that there's a unity consciousness at play here. So it feels to me like you're speaking directly to the fulcrum point of what can radically shift the consciousness from fragmentation to a living internet.
Yes. Well, people, I think, as far as I can see, people are beginning to realize now that the problems that we're facing around the world, poverty, ecocide, biospheric destruction and pollution, scarcity, you know, the list is endless, really. Well, it's not endless, but there's a long list of global systemic emergent problems that can't seem to be solved by just changing policies, or, you know, we seem to need something really radical to go beyond this level of existence. And what I would like to see is a thriving existence where everyone has, you know, Buckminster Fuller style, we meet the needs of 100% of humanity unconditionally. Everyone has food, shelter, water. How do we do that so we can thrive and unleash our creative potential? And it seems as though it's a shift in thinking. It's a fundamental shift in the way we think and perceive, because when you understand the process of creation and what's being called manifestation in the New Age literature and reality world, it really begins to some extent in the mind. So through the imagination, through our thinking, we create our experience and the physical reality. And a big part of that is how we think of ourselves in the world. So if I think of myself as being a purely physical being that's separate to everyone else, then that will lead to a certain way of behaving and a way of perceiving. And for me, in my own journey, and this is reflected in NUMAP, I've found a balance between being the whole and being the part, and that is being a whole and a part simultaneously, which is, again, a synergy more than the sum of its parts. So I am a separate individual and, you know, and I'm the whole. That's how I perceive myself now. And to me, that geometry is a balance between the masculine and feminine, the feminine being the whole, the circle, the masculine being a part. So it's a whole and a part, which is something novel. I liken it to the spiral. I kind of think of it as a spiral. Mm-hmm. Which is a balanced structure, which is also fractal. It's a simple fractal structure, a spiral. So if we start mapping everything with holons, I think that actually helps us to think in terms of holons. And what I was going to say about NUMAP specifically was that it's a technology, and when the nervous system, when the being interacts with the technology, adapts, we are adaptive, we adapt to things. So when you're using Facebook, you're adapting to Facebook. When you're using MySpace, you're adapting to MySpace or YouTube or whatever. And it has an effect on us. We adapt to it. It changes us. And then we we start to use it, and it really becomes an extension of the mind and body, the mind body. So people are saying we're already cyborgs, right? We are extending our mind into the technology already. We're already doing it, maybe just not fully consciously. So the iPhone becomes an extension of the mind body, and the memory in the iPhone becomes an extension of the nervous system. So I've reflected on that, and I thought, well, if I'm adapting to Facebook, what effect is that really having on me? Is that healthy for me, or is that healthy for the planet, or is it not healthy? And I started to feel like we needed to design technology that the effect it has on us is not neutral, it's actually beneficial. So with NuMap, I actually designed it so that it would have a positive effect on the nervous system, to, you know, as best it could, based on the understanding I had at the time. So if you look at nature, it's not made of boxes and lines. It's not made of Euclidean geometry. The basic shapes we use in our Western culture for architecture and in our thinking and science aren't really what nature uses. Nature tends to be more fractal and spirally and curvy, and there's a different kind of geometry to it. So my feeling was, if we could align ourselves with nature and the geometry nature's using, maybe when our nervous systems adapt to the technology, it would be more like it's adapting to nature, which is a healthier thing, because our physical bodies are essentially nature. Like, we're part of nature. We might feel like we're people, we might think we're people, but again, that's just a belief, that's just a perception. And the body has its own truth. The body is fractal, it's holonomic, it's made of, you know, there are body parts that contain sets of, you know, organs or you know, systems, and then those contain different tissues, and so there are all sorts of...
We're a galaxy within ourselves. We have 150 trillion cells, and each of those cells has DNA, and each of those DNA is like 2.5 inches long, so wow.
And you can totally see there's a mirroring, as above, so below style,
right,
between a human body and an ecosystem or a planet or a galaxy. And we really, and then this leads into the whole biocentric perception of consciousness, existence, the universe. It starts to look as though the universe is alive, the universe is a being. It's not just this empty clockwork, dumb machine. It's a intelligent system. It's alive. It's self-regulating, self-organizing, self-creating. It's autopoietic. It's syntropic. It's intelligent. You know, it's, who knows what's out there? I mean, I feel like we're only really perceiving our own little bubble of human consciousness in this vast sea of potential experiences, but it looks as though it's intelligent when we start to look at the new science and really suspend our kind of, you know, Newtonian, Cartesian belief systems that we inherited through the education system and, you know, sort of the mass media and whatever other inputs there are there. But going back to what I was saying, like the NuMap, because it's based on a geometry that is more resembling nature, I think that when we use it, it has a more of a beneficial effect on us. So when we adapt to NuMap, because its geometry is aligned with nature, we're adapting back to nature. So for me, I would say, I like to think of it as a mildly cognitive enhancing technology or a psychedelic technology.
It is.
Which means
it absolutely is. And I wanted to share a very brief story of my own experience of, you know, there's Daniel Pink. He's a well-known New York Times writer, bestseller, and one of his books is called The Whole Brain Thinking and Why Right-Brainers Will Rule the Future. And he talks about how we've been so left-brain, and we've come to the limits of that aspect of ourselves in terms of handling the complexity on the planet and the crises and the ability to tap into the collective intelligence. And so with that in mind, I remember being on NuMap with you, and half an hour, and we were zooming in and out, and I have to describe how the holons work. Like, you can go zoom in infinitely and zoom out, and you can always be feeling the part and the whole. And when we got off NuMap and then we started talking, not being on inside NuMap, you were talking, and I had, because I'm so clairsentient and very kinesthetic, I had the experience of my right brain and my left brain were talking to each other in a new way. And I called it, I'm like, oh my gosh, I am experiencing holonic listening. not just listening from what I know or listening at the left brain or even the right brain, but this whole brain listening. And it was directly, and that was a half an hour within NUMET. So I really can imagine that there is this profound rewiring happening because of it. And so that mildly psychedelic is like opening the doors of perception and our capacities to access more of our brain's capacity. Right now they say that we're at 10%. It feels to me like what you're talking about is opening the doors into greater access to our intelligence and our wisdom of not just ourselves, but of the membrane around the larger field. So being able to, like Bruce Lipton talks about, like, oh, then that larger holon of that larger system, we can actually touch into that intelligence and access it with NUMAP in a way that we can't with the current system.
You know, as a holon, we're part of many different systems. Nature knows we're part of the biosphere, for example. And if we just think with the left brain, we might not recognize the context, yeah, the whole, and that we're in. Like, we're in a community, we're in the biosphere, we're in the planet, we're in the galaxy, we're in the universe. And to me, all of these perspectives are equally valid and equally useful and relevant. And I think that if we could see ourselves as a part of a larger whole and simultaneously individuals, then we would consider maybe the effects of our actions on people the other side of the earth. And I think this is what we need to really make the shift. We need that kind of awareness, because I mean, you pick up a phone and you can affect the energy on the other side of the earth. I mean, that's technologically, perhaps there's other ways of affecting the earth that we don't recognize, but we are becoming a global culture, global civilization. And I think that unless we really align ourselves with nature, and that includes the way nature thinks and self-organizes, then we're going to find it hard to survive, let alone thrive. But I do think that we can thrive absolutely, totally. And if possible, I'd really like to discuss the application of NUMAP, because to me, that's equally important. You know, how do we use the technology? Are we just going to do whatever we want, or is there some kind of alignment that we need to make with nature? And it feels like that, doesn't it? It's like, you know, we can't just use an arbitrary bit of technology and ignore the consequences to the trees and the air. It's important that we have this awareness, this right brain function of the context that we're playing in. We're growing up as a species and we're becoming more aware of the consequences of our actions. We can't just have a party and leave a mess everywhere. We need to, you know, have a, you know, it's conscious partying. We can have fun and live in bliss and ecstasy, but we can't just, you know, soil
our environment.
We
can't throw things away anymore. There is no away. Throw it away. No, there
exactly.
is no away.
And unless we trash the planet and then expand into space and trash more and more planets. And I don't think that's advisable, but so what can we do? We can align ourselves. What does that mean? And it seems to me like a fundamental concept is homeostasis. What's coming up for me in the right now, and to be in the right now, and when obviously in the moment that this is recorded, is the word syntony. Syntony is the alignment with creation experienced as inner motivation, inner knowing, intuition. From an archetypal perspective, it's this more feminine, the feeling, the subjective, that our patriarchal, sort of more masculine culture is neglected maybe. And it seems that through the feminine energy, we can bring back in our intuition and inner motivation and the feeling. And through that, we can align ourselves with nature. We want to create and apply NUMAP so that it acknowledges this subjective feeling, syntonic intelligence, syntonic knowing. And that is leading me to map specific frequencies and do specific things. And mainly it's sort of going within and following your bliss. And the word that comes up is passion. So it seems as though everyone has something that excites them inside. And maybe it was more conscious, more obvious when they were a child, and it can get buried. But inside everyone, there's something that we're excited about and that brings us a lot of joy. It's a self-rewarding action. It's usually creative. And what you find is that when people are in their bliss and doing what they would naturally be doing if they had all their needs met, you know, and they're just having fun, they're playing, what they create actually benefits not just them, but the whole. Now, that's actually not arbitrary or a coincidence. To me, that's actually indicative of higher intelligence, actually probably programmed in the DNA. And I don't want to get, I'm getting a bit speculative because I don't have the...
No, but that's perfect because that goes back to Abraham Maslow and self-realization and human individual potential into social potential, and absolutely is like where we're evolving to.
Exactly. And Barbara's narrative and, you know, universal humanity, and we're moving into a new way of... It's like universal humanity. It's beyond the planet. It's extraterrestrial. There's the supramental force. And it's all kind of leading us to see that we're not at the top of the hierarchy in terms of the evolutionary, you know, ladder or whatever, however you want to perceive it. There is intelligence beyond human intelligence, not just out there, but here, because here is here. There is only here from one perspective. But,
maybe frame a little bit for us about the profile for the holons and the contact holons, just a little bit of a sketch within NUMAP as the a kind of a social network, because this is a fundamental sort of aspect of what NUMAP is and what you've been intuiting with the syntonic order of the cosmos.
Yeah, so we want to use NUMAP and apply it to really facilitate and empower this new emerging paradigm of co-creation. And co-creation, it involves this syntonic dimension. It involves this inner motivation. It involves this passion that we feel. So we're going to be mapping and things like the actual set of frequencies, the set of holon types, if you like, are right now passion, vision. And it kind of begins with passion and vision, and then desire, intention, skill, resource. And then we have additional things like events. But the just mapping those first five frequencies of co-creation, vision, passion, desire, intention, skill, and then maybe resource is a sixth one, that will allow us to make visible the energy around us in a way that helps us co-create. So we're going to be able to see each other's passions. We're going to be able to see each other's visions. That a vision really is like a big desire, something that we really want, that is maybe like a dream. It's like, you know, free shelter throughout the planet for everyone, or clean oceans, or, you know, a vision is like a big desire. And a passion is something that brings us excitement and makes us feel alive. So we can make visible those energies around us. Imagine everyone mapping their visions and passions. So that's the first two frequencies. The next two, desire and intention, become relevant when we start to act on those passions and visions, and we start to create around those passions and visions. We start to follow our bliss, our passion, and create things. We start to look at our vision and think, how can I make that happen? How can I make that real and physical? So we have specific desires that spring up, and out of those desires spring specific intentions, and then actions follow. So there's this spectrum of co-creation or manifestation in terms of the frequencies, and we can map the energy around us on those specific frequencies. And then once we can see what people are passionate about, what visions are there, what is wanted and what is desired, and what people are intending and what they're doing, and maybe the skills and resources involved in those actions, then we can use that data to actually facilitate the process of creation or co-creation itself, to empower communities to self-organize and manifest their dreams. And I think that's how we're going to co-create the new Earth, by seeing what is around us and connecting spontaneously based on our inner motivation rather than some external thing or agenda or system that's being imposed on us, rather than acting out of survival and, you know, choosing from a predefined set of jobs that are really just there to kind of perpetuate our existence and to meet our basic needs. We can somehow free ourselves of that by meeting our basic needs in ways that don't compromise our ability to pursue our passion and our visions. And then when enough people do that together, we'll see that it's not arbitrary. The visions and the passions we have are part of a larger plan. And when we act on our passions and visions and co-create, we become like a puzzle piece that fits together with everyone else becoming a puzzle piece. And the puzzle is Gaia, and the puzzle is Gaia's plan, because it's a planet. It's an extraterrestrial plan. So you see where it's going. And
it's beautiful. Chris, I want to just, I don't want to interrupt you, but we have just 3 minutes, and I don't want to cut you off in 2 minutes or in 3 minutes. So we clearly need to do part two to really go and dive into kind of the application. And I love how you're mapping the frequencies of co-creation. And then what I want to make sure that we cover before we're done is a place to connect with you. And also, if you would want to name for people any needs of you and NewMap that we could just plant into the noosphere in this moment, because we can continue to plant that request out there. So let's just make sure people can find a way to connect with you. How would you like them to do that?
My website right now. So I'm saying that because it might change. So I'll have a contact me page on my website. And then if you look on there, then I'll put on there the best way to contact me.
Perfect. So that's Larky, L-A-R-K-Y .org, right?
Yeah. And also chrislarkin.com as well. But yeah, either of those two.
Perfect. Perfect. So for everybody, that's easy. Larky.org. And NewMap will be arriving. You'll be able to dance in that field soon, but through Chris, this is a great doorway. And quickly, anything that's right at the top of your list that you'd like to name for a need, and then we'll just close in like 30 seconds.
I think the number one thing is we need enthusiastic, passionate people who resonate with us coming forwards and co-creating with us. And beyond that, we could do with more money, financial support, without strings attached that take us out of this new frequency and energy.
Now, if this seems rather speculative, let's reflect with the help of a snippet from episode 511 on the way that decisions are currently made about resource allocations.
To sort out the mess that he left behind. But maybe he, one day, perhaps we'll have to wait for his memoirs, could account for his role in the most disastrous decision of all, which is the illegal invasion of Iraq.
Yeah. Nick Clegg in Prime Minister's Questions yesterday. Well, in the last 24 hours, Downing Street has sought to explain that the Deputy Prime Minister was speaking in a personal capacity and that his comments do not constitute official government policy.
So, not to put too fine a point on it, the system as it currently exists is ever more rapacious. More people go to bed hungry. What it would be like if you had a conscience to be working where you know you're responsible for the deaths of millions of people and not to do anything about it. I would have thought it would have been almost unbearable. So perhaps that's strong evidence that the Deputy Prime Minister is in fact a psychopath rather than just a sociopath. Well, increasingly people are doing things about it. I don't want this to be a pessimistic episode. I see more and more serious challenges to the existing social order. I think there are people, yes, at the top who appear pretty determined to try to ride this tiger, who, if necessary, seem ready to destroy planet Earth to save it. I'm not with Maurice Berman on this. I don't think their power is going to last for much longer. I'm a big fan of a Truth and Reconciliation Committee. Maybe we can replace these rather puerile notions of punishing wrongdoing with a more mature and thoughtful approach about how we can create the world in which we would like to live. We didn't talk much about law and justice in this show so far, but if Chris Larkham's idea of NoMap come to fruition, then an economic system which replaces the money system will, I think, in very short order also replace the existing legal system. Why would we need to have hierarchically defined mechanical justice when we have a much more direct, less abstract, and a much more personal decision-making tool available to us? I would like to conclude with a dedication I confess I didn't choose 511 at random. It was some audio that was provided to me by a long-time unwelcome guests listener and close friend of mine, Alex the Speaker's Wooldridge, who is now no longer with us. My heart goes out to his family, and I would like to personally say on air what a fine bloke he was and how much I loved him. Let that be an encouragement to all of us to express the love that we have within us. Let us follow our hearts, live our dreams, and do what we can to think outside the box and live an authentic life beyond money. This and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net. Thank you all for your contributions. I couldn't make this show, and I wouldn't make this show if there weren't a lot of people, such as Alex, who contributed either feedback on existing episodes, ideas for future episodes, or material which deserves a wider audience. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I would encourage you to give all you can to help other people to escape the trap that is money.
To help these poor workers, the rich will come down like a
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness.
Arne Gundersen visits refugees of Fukushima. After the explosions and meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant on March 11, 2011, 160,000 people were evacuated. 5 years later, almost 100,000 of them are still living in refugee housing. Their homes, land, and towns are still too radioactive for life. The current Abe government of Japan has begun a campaign to end the refugee crisis by a variety of measures. By changing the radiation standards and telling the exiled that it is now safe to go home. By ending disaster payments as well as cost of living allowances unless they return to the broken down ghost towns or relocate to other parts of Japan. In several cases, Arne Gundersen was the first outsider who came to visit these refugee colonies that are scattered across Japan. Their personal stories hold a kind of truth and significance that no official statements can convey. What Arne Gundersen had to offer the refugees in return is 45 years of experience. He was a licensed reactor operator who taught reactor physics and served as senior vice president for the nuclear industry. His expertise is in nuclear power engineering design defects, safety flaws, decommissioning, and dismantlement. He became a whistleblower in 1990 and lost his job and even his home. He's now an independent consultant. Here's part of his diary on his moving and heartbreaking meetings with refugees. Arne Gundersen by phone from Japan, recorded in March 2016 by the crew at his nonprofit, fairwinds.org.
Today I went to a resettlement community, and there were 22 women who met us out of 66 families that live in this resettlement community. And they stood up and they said, "My name is... and I'm in 6A. My name is, and I'm in 11B. And that's how they define themselves, is where they, you know, the little cubicle that they lived in. It was very sad. And they had their unofficial mayor, the woman who sort of runs all the groups. And she was very nice. And she told us that after the disaster at Fukushima, her hair fell out, she got a bloody nose, and her body was speckled with hives and boils. And the doctor told her it was stress, and she believes him. It was absolutely amazing. And we explained that those are all symptoms of radiation, and she should have it looked into. And she really felt like her doctor had her best interests in heart, and she was not going to pursue it. So they told us that we were the first people in 5 years to come to them and talk to them about radiation. Nobody in 5 years of their exile had ever talked to them about radiation before, which was another terribly sad moment. So I asked them, I said, "Who do you trust?" And they said, "Well, we get a letter from TEPCO once a month, Tokyo Electric Power Company, and we read the local newspaper, and that's how we get our information." So we asked them what it was like. Did they feel isolated from the rest of Japan? And they said some of them have changed their license plates so they're not in Fukushima anymore, so that their license plates show they're from another location. But when they drive back into Fukushima and people realize that they're natives, people deliberately scratch their cars, because they're sort of traitors. And then we had the opposite hold true. The people didn't change their plates. And when they left Fukushima and went to other areas, people deliberately scratched their cars because they were from Fukushima. It was really sad. It's a small minority of people, but it keeps you constantly on your toes about who you can trust. This animosity toward you, as if you're the person that caused the nuclear disaster.
Isn't it true, Arnie, that after World War II, the survivors of the bombing at Nagasaki and Hiroshima were taunted a lot, and also many of them had to not tell their stories or say they had been at either Nagasaki or Hiroshima because they were the untouchables?
We have one with us. We have a 76-year-old man who was 6 years old when the bomb was dropped. And he talked eloquently today about the people who tried to hide their identities, the problems that they encountered, because when they hid their identities, they couldn't get the medical services that they needed for the injuries they had experienced from the bomb. But then if they told everyone they were from Nagasaki or Hiroshima, they were ostracized in the communities. There was no safe place to be. Now, he's 76 and spoke to the women about his experience, and they were very grateful to hear that they're not alone with the stigma of being exposed to radiation. And he told me that for the first 5 years after the bomb, he was a medical wreck. He was emaciated and lots of medical problems, which over time he overcame. And by the time he was 20, he became an Olympic bicyclist. He was affected by the bomb, and through good food and good medicine was able to recover and has lived a full life. So he's a pretty special human being, wonderful man. And he's one of the lucky ones. He's 76 and doesn't have cancer and is active and vital. So it's very much an individual lucky situation. He was not at ground zero, but he was near enough to be, you know, contaminated and experience the disaster. So, you know, most of the people at ground zero were obliterated in a flash. So he's a special man.
One of the things that you've talked about and Marco has talked about is internal radiation exposures and hot particles. What's the difference between a bomb exploding and a nuclear plant exploding and hot particles?
Most of the bomb exposure was from a direct flash that was over in seconds. There wasn't a significant amount of contamination on the ground because the bomb went off 1,000 feet in the air. So there was not a lot of the radiation residual left on the ground for hot particles to get into people's lungs. There were people downwind that breathed in hot particles from the thunderstorms that it created, things like that. But
you mean in fallout?
Yes, in fallout, downwind from the Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And they experienced something called the black rain, and dust particles did come down hundreds of miles away. And so those people are also exposed. But he was at very near ground zero, so his exposure was a flash of external radiation, not a lot of internal radiation to damage organs. And that's not what we're seeing in Fukushima Daiichi. Everything I'm finding here is millions and billions of very, very small particles that are spread pretty much everywhere. We'll know a little bit more about that in the future.
I appreciate you answering the question. I've been wondering about it because they were trying to claim everything is okay in Japan. Look how well most of the Japanese recovered from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so, therefore, it's okay. Don't look this way. There's nothing here to see.
Yeah, there's no comparison between a bomb and what happened to Fukushima. The bomb obliterated maybe a pound of uranium. And it was 1,000 feet in the air, so most of it went up almost immediately. Whereas each of the nuclear reactors at Fukushima had 100 tons of uranium in them, so that the quantity of radiation that's spread out throughout the countryside is orders of magnitude higher at Fukushima than it was at Nagasaki. You know, we had another thing that amazed me was the way the Japanese are paying off the victims is creating a lot of animosity. This community was special. All 22 women knew each other for a long time. Some were in their 60s, and one was as young as 17. And one of the women in her 60s was living with her 88-year-old mother when the disaster occurred. So, and the 88-year-old mother was in fine health and loved her community. And when they moved her, she fell apart and died very quickly because she wasn't in the environment she was used to. And she's actually listed as one of the fatalities now. There's over 1,000 people who the Japanese say, you know, died as a result of the nuclear disaster. So she's one of those people. The 17-year-old is not allowed to go back in. The Japanese don't let women under 18 back in. So we asked her, when you turn 18, will you go back? And she said, I will go back once to pay my respects, and I will never go back again. But the older women had a different attitude. You know, it was the home of their children, and their ancestors are all there. You know, the family ancestral burial grounds are all there, and they have to take care of their ancestors so that they desperately want to go back. We had one woman who cannot go back. She's been told that her house is an area is so contaminated she will never go back. And then we had other women who were been told they might have to wait 3 or 4 or 5 more years, but they probably will go back. And then we had a few that thought they might go back in a year or two. Now, what the Japanese government does is when you never can go back, they give you a lump sum of money, which allows you to buy a house. And in some communities, there's a lot of animosity because these people can now have a house and they don't have to live in these resettlement situations. And the other people who may go back in 5 years are not given any money, and they're kept in these resettlement communities and in limbo until their homes are ready. One of the women lost her house in the tsunami, but the ground around it was so contaminated that she could never build there. So what the Japanese government did was they paid her for the foundation.
That's horrible.
So she got nothing for the house that was destroyed. She got a small amount of money for the foundation of the house, which can never be built on because it's too radioactive. And she's essentially stuck in this resettlement home for life. Yeah, you're right. It's horrible. Now, in some communities, these tensions manifest themselves in all sorts of internal hatred. But this community seemed to overcome it. There was a wonderful woman from Rwanda who escaped the Rwandan genocide because she spoke Japanese, and they got resettled in Fukushima and then had to flee Fukushima. But she seemed to be the spark plug to keep people happy and glad that they had each other.
I think back to Dante, and I think back to purgatory. You know, limbo, being in limbo is purgatory, and just a hellacious place to be. And it's, to my way of thinking, it's so incongruous with how I see Japan. And I look at these pictures that you sent of where you went yesterday in the resettlement village, and there's no feeling of permanency. There's no feeling to put the artistic and spiritual beauty back in the environment that I have always internalized as being Japanese.
When we left, they sang a song to us. One of them is an accomplished musician, and she wrote a beautiful song about their hometown. And they sang it, and it was haunting. It was so beautiful. And they talked about how nice the town was and all the special things in the town and how sad they felt to leave it. And that was the only time I saw them cry. Every one of them broke into tears at the end of the song. You know, the scars are deep. They seem to be focused their lives together, and that's more important than where they live and how they live, is that they're all together. It was very special, but terribly sad. And after that, we went to see a family that was in the lumber business, and their hillside that they take the lumber from is so contaminated they can't use it anymore. So they have to actually import lumber from around the country. So we asked the family, what's changed for you since the disaster? And their answer was swift. Everything has changed. Nothing is as it was. And then they went and they used to go up into the woods to, to not just to harvest their livelihood, the wood, but they used the fruits and vegetables and mushrooms and things like that that were up in the forest to live on. And they can't get any of that. They can't eat the shiitake mushrooms. They can't eat the fruits that are up there. They can't use the ferns, the salad. There's absolutely nothing in their life that hasn't been torn out from under them. The personal toll, you can't quantify it. There's no way to put a dollar figure on any of this. There's 160,000 people that are each individually experiencing this. And you had it right. I think I used the word, it was limbo. I said, these people are in that place. It's not heaven, not hell. And they just are in some sort of a holding pattern in their lives. And it was terribly sad to see the destructive force that the atom can be. All these women were in their 60s, and they said that they would go back because they know they'll probably die of something before they die of cancer. But their kids have already moved on. And their kids won't be back in the village that they grew up in. And their kids won't be back to take care of the ancestors. And then their grandkids are not allowed back now. And by the time they get to 18 years old, they will have forgotten the village. So the keepers of the village tradition are all 50, 60, 70 years old. And when they die, their kids are not going to keep that village alive. So it's very much a death sentence for the villages, a slow death. If they get back into them, there will be no generations to come.
What touched me is, by village, you mean their community, their sense, their entire community that had generations of tradition. And that is totally fragmented. And that's true for thousands of people.
Yeah, there's 160,000 people living in temporary housing, and 60,000 now have been displaced back into high radiation areas. But another 100,000 are still waiting to get pushed off and into high radiation areas that I don't believe they should be going back to. That's a lot of people. Now that's the size of it's the size of a big piece of the state of Fukushima. And their lives are permanently torn asunder.
The other thing that you said that really concerned me and upset me, women are so much more radiologically sensitive than men. These children are not allowed to go back until they're 18. But when they're 18, they can go back. And for women and 18-year-olds, that's when your reproductive organs are still really, really vulnerable. And you would go back, and if you were exposed and you were going to start a family, that's a really tragic amount of exposure for someone that age, don't you think?
Yeah, you know, little girls are 20 times more radio sensitive than older adults like me. Little boys are 10 times more radio sensitive. And by the time they hit 20 years old, they're still girls 3 or 4 times more radio sensitive, and young men about twice as radio sensitive as older adults. So, yeah, when you send a young family back, if they go back, and most are refusing to go back, they're moving on and lying about their location where they came from. But if they go back, they know that the likelihood of a cancer is dramatically higher than it would have been.
That was Arne Gundersen of fairwinds.org, talking with his wife, Maggie. He called in from his 2016 tour of Japan on the 5th anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. A week later, he had arrived at the Sendai nuclear power plant in Kobe. This phone call was recorded on March 3rd, 2016.
I'm in Kobe. That's the site of that huge earthquake back in 1995. But then we're heading down to the Sendai reactor. And that's the one that's right near the volcano. So I might get to see a volcano later. It was dormant for quite a long while. And then when the Japanese decided to start up Sendai, the gods decided to start up the volcano.
So who will be your audience today?
The audience is a mixture. We've spoken to a lot of YMCA organizations, believe it or not. But we also spoke to UNICEF. And just yesterday, I spoke to the Kobe Co-op. If you're in the States, you think of these co-ops as the little local store you've got in town. But the Kobe Co-op has got an 8-story building. They're just absolutely huge. So, you know, I think the interesting thing is, regardless of who I'm speaking to, they're all interested. We bumped into a lot of women. And I'm sure there's hundreds, if not thousands of them in southern Japan who have taken their kids and left. Yesterday, I met one, and she said her parents are calling her, and the exact word was a traitor to Japan because she's left. Another woman told us that her family told her that if everybody ate the same food and everybody went and hung out together in Fukushima Prefecture, it would be fine because everybody was there. A famous doctor here in Japan is saying that the best cure for radiation is smiling. You know, the pressure these families are on to reunite in Fukushima Prefecture is enormous. But I have to give the women a lot of credit. They are against all odds. They've taken their kids and they're in a much safer location.
Arne, do you know what they're now doing for a living, job-wise, or how these women are being able to support their children and support themselves while they're going against family and potentially their spouses?
They find jobs in the local communities. When their families are intact, their husbands continue to send them money. One of the women I met, more than one, there's several whose husbands are divorcing them. And in the Japanese court system, if the judge believes that there's no such thing as radiation and that her fears are unfounded, the kid goes back with the father. And there's a lot of that here. You know, but the other interesting thing is that there are many communities who want these women. Japan's rural areas are depopulating. Some of these villages have half the houses are empty. As people die and the young people go to the cities, large portions of these little tiny towns are unpopulated. So a lot of cities are competing to get these families back into a home, and there's actually agencies that do it. But the problem is a lot of the women go, but the husbands stay behind. So we're having these broken families.
Let me see if I get this right. These cities that are not near Fukushima Daiichi and not near the radiation are recruiting people who have been living in refugee camps or who are refugees from the radiation to come and live in homes that they have there that they could provide for them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they're nice homes, and these are nice villages. You know, the problem that, from the women's standpoint is that the village doesn't come with them. All of the village ties, you know, they can't take the entire village. But there's enough houses in some of these towns to take, you know, a half a dozen or a dozen families in a dozen homes. So it is possible you could be with your group of friends, but not your entire village. The biggest issue, it seems to me, and this far south in Japan, far away from Fukushima, is they'd like to keep these rural towns alive. So they're actually encouraging of it. But the government doesn't want to. Somebody told me yesterday that the government's motive here is they don't want any refugees by the time the Olympics happen in 2020. Their position is you either move back or you have moved to another community. But all of the funds for refugees will be eliminated so they can tell the world that Fukushima has been solved. The people in the prefecture who stay are just absolutely unwilling to admit there's any radiation anywhere. But I think the moms really understand that, especially while their children are young, the best thing to do is to get the heck out regardless of the social pressure. It's sad. It's ripping the society apart at a time when they really should be drawing together. And it looks to me like the issue of moving people out of Fukushima could help these towns that are dying because the old people are moving on.
Arnie, what else would you like to share with us from your meetings and interviews?
Well, I personally met a doctor the day before yesterday. His clinic was put out of business by the Japanese government. What they did was they never really said, we're putting you out of business. They just stopped paying his bills. He was treating people, and on the symptoms, he would say, you know, radiation related. So any bill he submitted that was radiation related, they refused to pay. You know, we've had the doctors say they were threatened with hospital privileges and things like that. But this is just another one of those schemes. The guy had to close his clinic because he wasn't being reimbursed for the services. The Japanese government's position is when your hair falls out and your nose starts to bleed and you're hacking up blood, that's all stress related. And unless you put on the form that it's stress-related as opposed to radiation-related, they just refuse to pay.
Well, you did say there was that one person who said, if you put a smile on your face, then it'll all go away.
That's a commonly held attitude. I mean, that was the highest-ranking person in government to say it. But this issue, if we all hang together, then the radiation will be fine. There's, you know, obviously there's no scientific basis on it, but it's just the culture of if we all do the same thing, then we'll all be protected. You know, it reminds me of that nursery story about the emperor has no clothes. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the crowd was convinced that the emperor had a beautiful gown on. And as long as they all told the same story, everything was fine until the little kid chirped out, you know, this guy's naked. And that's really the role the mothers have here. The mothers are saying that this is a scam. I'm not going to risk my kids' health because you want to sing a happy song. So they've moved on.
That was Arnie Gundersen. You heard phone calls he made to the crew at his nonprofit, fairwinds.org. He spoke live from Japan during his February-March 2016 visit on the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. And if you would like to hear more, go to the website fairwinds.org. That's fairewinds.org. This is the conclusion of a four-part series made in appreciation of Gundersen's work. Gundersen had been invited to speak to community groups in Japan on the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima meltdown. And as I'm sending you by radio his telephone reports in mid-March 2016, he is still there, learning and teaching. Gundersen has made many visits to Japan since 2011 and is well known and respected there. His book, Fukushima Daiichi, Truth and the Way Forward, was translated into Japanese and is a bestseller. Arne Gundersen has consulted on nuclear energy safety for the State of Vermont, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, Sierra Club, and the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. He testified on the Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown and the San Onofre and Vermont Yankee nuclear plants. Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin called Gundersen the only person in the state of Vermont who's been right on every single prediction of what might happen at Vermont Yankee. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Who we are and where we come from is a crucial question that now we are more able to answer than ever before. The examination and analysis of our individual DNA, in addition to answering a myriad of medical and forensic secrets about ourselves, also reveals the mix of our individual ancestors and the paths they took. This analysis provides significant and untold information about who we are, from where we came, and how we may connect with our ancestors. Dr. Alondra Nelson, the Dean of Social Science and a Professor of Sociology and Gender Studies at Columbia University in New York City, is our guest in this edition of Radio Curious. Professor Nelson is the author of The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome. She's also the author of Body and Soul, which she and I have previously discussed here on Radio Curious. To discuss the social life of DNA, Professor Nelson and I visited by phone from her office in New York City on February 19, 2016. We began by noting that although human beings are all members of the human race, people are grouped by skin color and/or facial features and are characterized as being of a different race.
We are all Homo sapiens. We look differently. We have different hair textures and skin colors and eye color. But there's no necessary reason why that has to mean different hierarchies or different kinds of social statuses. And so when particularly social scientists talk about race being a social construction, certainly what we're trying to get at is that the way that we look, although it's different from one another, each of us individually, the meanings that we give to those could be lots of different meanings. And the fact that over human history, the meaning of that difference has meant racial hierarchies, has meant justifications for one group to oppress another, one group to make assumptions about another, is not a natural thing. And so that's where the social construction piece comes into it. With regard to ethnicity, you know, I think there are debates about whether ethnicity is a category that's like race. That's a kind of essentialist category about innate difference, but that is more on a cultural sort of valence. or whether ethnicity is about culture and foodways and mores or something in between. What was interesting in my research around genetic ancestry testing has been the highlighting of the fact that all American social groups don't have access or haven't historically had access to ethnicity as a social identity. So one of the reasons I suggest that genetic ancestry testing is so popular, particularly among African Americans, is because African Americans, as a large community, haven't had access to ethnic identities.
At the beginning of your book, you tell the story of Venture Smith, a man who lived between 1729 and 1805. And you present the question, why is DNA analysis deemed to pro-offer more valuable and reliable information about a man's familial history than his own words?
The Venture Smith story is fascinating because it's one of the very few what we call slave narratives, which are stories, biographies, autobiographies written by formerly enslaved people, often about their sort of flight or their manumission out of slavery. And in the Venture Smith case, unlike most of this small group of slave narratives that we have been able to recover, he talks about his life on the African continent. He talks about his village and his family. He talks about what's called the Middle Passage, the journey from the west coast of Africa, in his case, to New England. Ultimately, he lived and died in colonial Connecticut. And so we know his whole story. And part of one of the aims often of root seeking, be it the kind of Alex Haley version of the 70s or the 21st century version, is that African Americans want access to information about their time before the Middle Passage. Who were their people before they were brought to the Americas as part of the transatlantic slave trade? So Venture Smith is an interesting case because several years ago there's a research effort to exhume his body and do genetic analysis on his body to effectively find out where he comes from. And yet Venture Smith has already told us where he comes from in his own words, translated perhaps by someone who helped to help him to write this, but mostly I think we can say his own in full accounting. And moreover, historians tell us that the story is remarkable because it's one of the few slave narratives that we have that go back to life on the African continent. So we know more about Venture Smith than we know about lots of people, even including famous historical figures of this period. So it was curious to me doing the research, why do we need to do genetic analysis on his remains if we have all of this information? And so part of the answer to that question for me is twofold. One is about what I call the social power of DNA, that DNA has more ability to give us a scientific, unbiased, and I'm putting these in quotes, truth than one's own stories. In a moment of biotechnology, and we live in a very technological, scientifically advanced society, one might understand why we would turn to science to answer these questions. Another answer came from talking to the descendants of Venture Smith who know each other, who have a very rich family tree and get together for an annual family reunion at his gravesite in Connecticut. And they were saying, when asked, why do you want to do this genetic analysis, given that you know already all of this information about this very now famous ancestor? And one of his descendants says, well, we want to help educate the American public and the school children about his experience. And another says, I hope that it can bring healing. To me, these answers struck a chord, that it was, on the one hand, this genetic analysis of his remains about our overinvestment in the power of genetics and DNA, on the one hand, but on the other hand, on our emotional investment and our yearning for DNA as the symbol of truth, to be able to answer some fundamental questions about justice, about racial reconciliation, and about healing.
Staying with Venture Smith for a minute, what different information became available with the DNA analysis of Venture Smith as compared to his personal narrative of his life and his ancestry?
Well, the Venture Smith case is a curious one because this endeavor fundamentally fails, in fact, because his remains are degraded so much so that even with today's advanced technology, there wasn't enough biological evidence remaining that they could sample it and amplify it and analyze it.
I garner this from your book, that one of the goals of the genetic analysis is to look back and restore the pre-enslavement identity and the biology and how things shifted through the cultural transitions. This is an extension, I think, of the Venture Smith story as to how that's done, the restoration of the pre-enslavement identity compared to where a person is in their station in life who has ancestry from the continent of Africa, but not being able to pinpoint it as to which part of this vast continent.
That's the key question. And as a researcher, I had been personally reconciled with that just being the case. I know I am of African descent, and that's okay with me. In the course of doing my research, interviewing genealogists, going to genealogy societies and conventions, going to history conferences, I met a great deal of people who were unlike me, and I realized I was an outlier who really felt like they deserved to know and wanted to know as specific as they could possibly get about their specific African ancestry, their specific African heritage at a specific place in a specific language group in a specific community or nation state. And part of that goes back to the ethnicity piece that we were talking about. So if we can think by comparison of the experiences of other people in the United States or any other societies that are comprised of people who migrate from other places, which are most communities these days. But in the United States, we're a country of Americans, all one Americans, but also of many hyphenated identities. And we celebrate being Italian-American and German-American and Irish-American. And we celebrate this in holidays, and we celebrate this foodways, and we celebrate these with flags and things that we might wear and these sorts of things. So the difference for African Americans is that Africa, as you said, is a large continent. It's a continent that contains dozens of countries, hundreds of ethnic groups, hundreds of languages and dialects. So African American is not an ethnic identity, but a vague to some continental identity. And so what the genetic ancestry testing offers is the ability for people of African descent, through the inferences that they receive from companies like the African Ancestry Company, to say, I'm not only African American, I'm also Nigerian American, or I'm Ghanaian American. It restores ethnicity to African Americans that was removed from black people as part of the slave trade. So I write about the historian, Michael Gomez, who helps us to remember that because people for the transatlantic slave trade were brought often from all over the continent of Africa, they practiced different religions, they spoke different languages, they were from different tribal groups, ethnic groups, historical experiences. But through the process of the Middle Passage, they all become enslaved men and women, and they all become, frankly, just black. They take on a kind of racial and caste identity when the system of slavery commences that by mandate strips away all of these particular ethnic ways of being and ways of knowing about oneself. And as generations go forward, a lot of this information is lost within families and groups and the like. And so part of what one might say is that one of the losses or the traumas of transatlantic slavery is the loss of those specific ethnic identities. And part of what some of the people I spoke to seek to do is to restore those identities through the use of genetic analysis.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Professor Alondra Nelson, the Dean of the Social Science Department at Columbia University, where she is a professor of sociology and gender studies. We're talking about her book, The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Alondra Nelson, the Middle Passage, can you define that for us?
The Middle Passage is a historical term that's used to describe, in very broad terms, the forced migration, anywhere from 3 to 14 million or 40 million, depending on who you ask, millions of Africans from the continent of Africa to the Americas, the United States, the Caribbean, Brazil, as commodity, as property, as part of the slave trade. People lose in the process of the Middle Passage their specific communities, language, and sometimes cultural ways, as well as members of their immediate family. That's not to say that there wasn't and hasn't been and continues to be a rich African-American culture, and that's not to say that there are these what are called retentions. There's linguistic retentions, there's retentions in food and dance that sort of persist over the last 300, 400 years. So we know in the Carolina Low Country, there are the Geechee and Gullah communities that share food with people in Sierra Leone, that share words and still linguistic ties with people in contemporary Sierra Leone. So some of these ties persist over time. But for, I think, the vast majority of African Americans, that's not the case. And we know that African American culture is very dynamic and resilient and has brought us unique political culture in the United States, musical culture that certainly has African elements but is something that emerges here in the United States, ways of seeing in the world, ways of being. So it's not to say that new rich forms of being weren't created and the absence or the loss of these ethnic identities that were one outcome of Middle Passage. At the same time, I came to understand in the course of speaking with people that they felt like they had the right to know about earlier ties and earlier ways of being if there was a way to try to access them.
Alondra Nelson, in your work, have you had the opportunity and can you share with us what you see among people who have had their genetic body analyzed and find a kinship with people of like background?
Yes, I see a range of things that range from one's individual response and individual interactions to bigger social historical issues, and I'll say a little bit about those. Part of my first interactions in doing this work with people were people telling me all my life I've wanted to know what my African roots were. Unsurprisingly, it can be the experience of getting genetic ancestry testing that give you some insight into that can be very emotional for people and in some cases can be quite transformative. I write about and talk about people who the test results become an occasion for them to get to know people in their local communities that they might not have known otherwise. One gentleman I write about gets tested and gets an inference to a community in Angola, and it makes him wake up to the fact that he's been sitting in a course, a college course, with a woman who's an immigrant from Angola. And the test results become the occasion for them to become friends. And at one point, there's an Angolan Independence Day celebration, and she invites him to attend. And he comes with some of his immediate nuclear family members, and they're really invited into this community of Angolan expatriates and are told, in fact, at this event to dance for their homeland. There are also people who immediately decide that they want to travel to the country or the community to which they've been linked. There are people who make efforts to get various forms of identity or identification in these communities. So countries like Ghana and Cameroon are, as part of their tourism industry, are looking at the possibility of offering diaspora passports or diaspora visas to people of African descent, and this may or may not be based on genetic analysis. We know that the actor Isaiah Washington now has dual citizenship in Sierra Leone through mitochondrial DNA analysis affiliated with a group in Sierra Leone. And so he received test results in 2004, and by 2010 he had a Sierra Leonean passport and has been doing lots of philanthropy there. So the emotional bond can run from interpersonal bonds that sort of stay in your community to transnational diaspora relationships and identities that transform and can even result in dual citizenship.
Currently, there is litigation in the United States about reparations for people whose ancestors were slaves. And I'd like you to discuss that, and in particular, the case that Professor Farmer Pellman brought against the international corporation Fleet Boston.
So in 2002, Deidre Farmer Pellman, a young law student, was the lead plaintiff in a class action suit for reparations for slavery that was filed against Fleet Boston and actually about 18 other multinational corporations that still exist today and that existed in some form, sometimes with the same name, like Lloyd's of London, sometimes not, during the slave trade and that profited from the slave trade and exist today on the cornerstone of those profits that were made during the slave trade. And these can be profits that were made from insuring enslaved people as property on behalf of slaveholders, in profits that were made by transporting enslaved people across the country on trains that are owned by what is now CSX, these sorts of things. And, you know, what's interesting is this case takes place in 2002. Genetic ancestry testing analysis only begins to emerge in the United States a year or two before this. And the reparations struggle has been a longstanding struggle. It goes back several centuries in the United States. And it's fascinating to me that within, you know, a year or so of the introduction of this new technology, that in this class action suit, the plaintiff saw this technology as a strategy that they might use to advance their case, their cause, their claims for reparations. So at one point in the case, which is now stalled, the court responds to the defendants in the case, the corporate defendants, who sort of say that the plaintiffs don't have standing, that they can't prove that they are the descendants of particular slaves and that they should be the ones who can bring this case to court. And what happens is that the plaintiffs regroup and they go to the genetic ancestry testing company, African Ancestry, and they purchase ancestry tests and they introduce these as evidence in the case. And what they're introducing as evidence is an inference that one of them, for example, was inferred to be related to contemporary people in the Niger, another in Gambia, another in Nigeria, as evidence that they have specific African roots, specific African ethnicities that are more specific than the identity African American, which is a large swath racial identity. And so this strikes me as a very interesting way in which the desire for identity and for a pre-Middle Passage identity really plays out on a kind of world historical scale with regard to a longstanding issue around race and reconciliation and healing and a really just a reckoning with the history of racial slavery in this country and the fact that unpaid labor was used for profit and gain.
Where is this case being litigated?
It's no longer being litigated. So it winded in and out of the courts from 2002 until about 2006. And it was in this last narrower case dismissed without prejudice so they could bring back certain aspects of the case. But effectively, the court said that the genetic test evidence that was introduced was still not specific enough to move forward. So the genetic evidence is not going to be successful in moving this forward. And when last I spoke to the lead plaintiff, Deidre Farmer Pellman, she said that they don't have enough resources to continue this. An appellate court in Chicago is where the case was last playing out, and this is the court that includes the conservative intellectual Judge Richard Posner, among other people.
Well, Professor Alondra Nelson, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask some questions about you. And one in particular is an aha or eureka moment that focused or changed your life or gave you a concept that there's something else out there you want to explore.
I think one of these moments, and I feel that I've had a lot, many of these moments, these crossroad moments or aha moments, but one of them certainly was when I completed the first draft of my first book on the Black Panthers' health activism, which I had the pleasure of speaking with you about several years ago. And it was partly about completing the book itself, which is a great accomplishment, but it was also because I think part of me was never, ever quite convinced that I could finish it. Being able to finish it actually opened up the possibility that my life could be a long-term project. The book is the aha moment, you know, the first draft of that first book. But what the lesson is for me is that there are journeys and things that we want to do in life, some of which offer no immediate gratification whatsoever, and some of which may never offer any kind of material or public gratification, but are things that offer meaning and are journeys that are worth taking.
And what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
It is one precious life. I want to spend time with love, be with the people who are important in my life, and really prioritize those. You know, I spend a lot of time each day trying to get that right. As a writer and as a thinker, I want to continue to tell unexpected stories about people of African descent in the U.S. and elsewhere, and also to tell more broadly unexpected stories about how technology and science shape our world in ways that are both detrimental and sometimes surprising.
And finally, Alondra Nelson, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
I would like to recommend a book to your listeners called Come Out Swinging. It came out in 2013, and it's by a woman named Lucia Trimbor, T-R-I-M-B-U-R. It's a fascinating book. It's a book that tells us about gentrification in Brooklyn. On the face of it, about a famous boxing gym in Brooklyn called Gleason's Gym. And the subtitle of the book is The Changing World of Boxing and Gleason's Gym. But it's really a book about change in a city. And it's a book about how people in dense cities learn to, through sport and through the small space of the gym, to dwell together, to be together, and how sport and boxing becomes a kind of bodily language that they use to deal with economic inequality, racial inequality. They're both men and women in the gym, and the way that the gym is changing as a place that goes from not only training amateur and professional boxers, but also young professionals on Wall Street and elsewhere who are coming into the space of the gym. So it's just a really fascinating story, a fascinating book, and it's a wonderful example of how we can look at a small social world like a boxing gym and how it just yields so many fascinating stories about how people try to live their best lives.
Well, Alondra Nelson, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Curious.
It was a pleasure, Barry. Thank you.
Professor Alondra Nelson is the author of The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome. She's the Dean of Social Science and a Professor of Sociology and Gender Studies at Columbia University in New York City. The book that Professor Nelson recommends is Coming Out Swinging by Lucia Trimbor. This program was recorded on February 19th, 2016. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new editions published regularly. You may stream, download, subscribe to our podcast service, and share them as you wish. They're all free. We appreciate your thoughts, ideas, and comments about our programs and enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541, and the address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. Christina Onnested and Yuko Kodama are the assistant producers. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.